Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the electrifying 11th episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
Beep boop boop beep boop boop beep boop beep boop beep boop beep boop 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 boop.
Folks, to pull back the curtain, just to let you know, I actually tried to replace Rob on the show. I
was rooting for this, by the way. I was totally in support of this.
And I'm stealing his joke. He's the one that joked about me replacing him. But anyway, I dug up my daughter's old Simon game, you know, the beep, boop, boop. But unfortunately, I played it for a while, but man, that thing's hard. But it doesn't make the kind of boops that we really need for this. So then I went in the garage and broke out my old 2XL, which is, besides us showing videos of this, do you know what 2XL is, Rob? Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah, it was its Amigo robot thing. Yeah. I didn't have it, but I remember it, sure.
So I grew up on this thing, and it's a trivia quiz thing with like three buttons, and it operates off an 8-track tape. It's amazing. And Sean Myers still works, and I'm horribly jealous. But anyway, I busted that out because he's got all kinds of beeps and boops, but sadly, it's dead, Jim. Mine doesn't work, so I don't know whether it's the power supply or what. So I am at a loss. Unfortunately, I think, Rob, we're going to have to keep you around.
Like I said, I was totally in support of being replaced by the old 2XL, but I don't know. Maybe you can get it fixed. Can you buy a new one on eBay? How much are the, much are the 2XLs?
Gosh, probably a gazillion dollars. Although I'm surprised someone hasn't made a new one. Although producing 8-track tapes would be a bit of a pain.
Yeah. We're back to vinyl, so maybe 8-track is on its way. Who knows? But anyway,
it could be a Thanksgiving miracle. By the way, I hope everyone had a happy Thanksgiving and hope you're all full of turkey and gravy and giblets as you sit down to listen to Who's Who Review.
As people drift off into their turkey comas, what better way to lull them into a slumber than listening to a 3-hour episode of Who's Who Review?
Exactly. And the whole reason we're doing this, folks, is simply because we love Who's Who. Now, each episode, what we do is we randomly select 13 characters from the first volume of Who's Who, which is that original 26-issue run. And that is 13 characters from the 819 entries that were in Who's Who. And I know because I counted, I had to take my shoes off and everything. And we use the randomizer to select 13 random numbers. And that's how we get our entries.
We love the Who's Who comics and the podcast in that order, and we wanted to find a way to continue the podcast. So this gives us the chance to talk about our favorite volume of Who's Who in a hopefully fresh new way.
Sure. Yeah, I believe that. Because I'm pretty sure some of my notes this time, I bet I said the same thing 12 years ago. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, yeah, I'm sure a lot of my stuff is exactly the same commentary.
Right.
With a little more lilt, but basically probably the same.
We talk slower. I know that because I listened to some of our old episodes and we talked a lot faster. I guess that's just age coming through. But, well, folks, before we get too much further, we need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Who's Who Review is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. What'd you bring, buddy?
Well, I picked a book not yet out. It comes out in February of 2026, Green Arrow, the Golden Age Omnibus Hardcover, Volume 1, which reprints all of Green Arrow's appearances from More Fun Comics, number 73, very big book for any Aquaman fan, 73 through 107, Adventure Comics 103 through 117, World's Finest 7 through 28, and includes a cover by Jay Bone, which is absolutely fantastic, and a foreword by Roy Thomas, where he gets into how he created Robin Hood. So it's all very exciting. I don't know the page count because it's not listed here, but listen to all the comics I just rattled off. It's probably 10,000 pages. Sure. But there's a lot of really great Green Arrow stuff. And I think it underscores how much of a fan I am of Green Arrow that I don't hold it against him that during his run in More Fun, which was at the same time as Aquaman, he always got the cover. Aquaman never got a cover. Aquaman never got a cover of More Fun Comics in his entire run. It was always Green Arrow. But I still love Green Arrow. So that, you know, that should tell you all I need to know about Green Arrow. So Green Arrow, Golden Age Omnibus Hardcover Volume 1 comes out February 2026. Oh, there's no price yet either. So I'm imagining it's going to be a really good deal because all the deals in Instock Trades are pretty good.
Well, it should be 40 to 42%. In fact, if you watch Instock Trades the first week, sometimes it's high as 50 or 55%. So just keep an eye out for that. Now, to be fair, also those More Fun Comics covers wasn't always Green Arrow that pushed out Aquaman. It was also Dr. Fate. Just want to say.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, okay. The reason I meant, yes. But Dr. Fate came before Aquaman.
True.
So, like, he was established. But to me, it's like Green Arrow and Aquaman debuted literally the same issue. And yet Aquaman never got a cover. Green Arrow, they clearly thought Green Arrow was a bigger stuff because he was a member of the Seven Soldiers of Victory. You know, like he got way more kind of attention than Aquaman ever did during the Golden Age. But nevertheless, those are a lot of fun stories. There's even one of them where he teamed up with Aquaman in the 50s, which was very rare.
Right.
They, you know, outside of Superman and Batman and like the JSA, they didn't really do team ups. But and the cover by Jay Bone is really beautiful. So, yeah, if you're a Green Arrow fan, check it out.
Awesome. And what month did you say that comes out?
February.
All right. Very cool. So my pick is ridiculously tangentially connected to what we're going to talk about today, but I don't care. This is Nightwing, A Night in Bloodhaven, or Bloodhaven, however you choose to call it, compendium number one trade paperback. So this is collects a ton of Nightwing comics. We're talking like 30 different Nightwing comics, plus like the Nightwing and Huntress miniseries and some other crossovers in Green Arrow and Robin and Detective Comics. Altogether, it's 1,040 pages. Majority of it's written by Chuck Dixon, but you got some Denny O'Neill in there. You got some Devin Grayson. You got art primarily by Scott McDaniel and Carl Story and others. It's full color. It's soft cover. Check this out. So because it's soft cover, again, 1,000 pages. It normally only goes for $59.99. Normally, if you're going to get one of these 1,000-page books, you're going to be paying like $150. So normally it goes for $59.99. It's 40% off right now, so you can get it for $35.99. $36 for 1,000 pages of amazing Nightwing comics. And again, it is tangentially, barely related to a character we're going to talk about today, but I don't care, and I'll explain it once we get to that character. Did you ever read the Nightwing series by Chuck Dixon?
I never have, no.
It was really good. It was a great way. I mean, I think it kind of helped pave the way to where we stand today, where Nightwing is kind of everybody's favorite. Like, everybody loves Nightwing. Everyone in the DC Universe looks up to him. Everyone thinks he's a great guy. And I think this kind of – I mean, obviously, New Teen Titans played a huge role in that, too. But I think this Nightwing series helped in that way, too. And that's where we get him, you know, battling Blockbuster. It's just such good stuff. Anyway, for these and all your other trade paperbacks at InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And apparently I have to buy a new 2XL. And a while ago, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. And if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support our show is by visiting what, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. In certain tiers, you get mentioned on your shows of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. So our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Mike Atchison, Nathan Archer,
Gord Tolton, Chuck Coletta, Corey Balanecki, Noah Tarnow, Phil Becker, Steve Givens, and Tom Panarese.
Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, folks, we will post these entries to the Fire and Water Podcast Network in the gallery post. And by we, I mean I do that. But anyway, Rob edits the episode, so I get the easy job. Anyway, so those will be out there for you to look at and leave your comments on their website because that is where we're going to be pulling your feedback from that we'll answer in just a bit. And Rob, I don't know about you, but I'm excited about these 13 entries. We've got it's a little different, I feel like, because like we see, well, I won't, it doesn't, I'm babbling here, but I feel like this collection was a little more obscure for some of the characters, and I feel like we got some different artists than we normally get. So this is kind of exciting. We've got some of them we know, obviously, like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name.
Kurt Swan.
Mike Grell.
Carmen Infantino, who is in every single episode of Who's Who Review.
That is true. Jack Kirby.
Murphy Anderson.
Dennis Cowan, who we don't get too often.
Chuck Patton.
Don't get him too often. Jerome K. Moore. Never get him. That's awesome.
Steve Ditko.
That's, I mean, I can't remember very many Steve Ditko entries at all. So this is exciting and a whole bunch more. So you ready to do this, buddy?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Rob, fire up that randomizer.
All right. I'm doing it extra long.
I can tell.
Complained about it the last time. So, okay. Our first listing is Bizarro World, drawn by Kurt Swan and Carl Kiesel. We see Bizarro, and then he's flying down, and we see the Bizarro Batman, Bizarro Green Lantern, who's Yellow Lantern, Bizarro Crypto, and then Bizarro Lois and Perry and Jimmy Olsen. And then there's a little inset of the planet, the square planet. Now, it doesn't list the first appearance of Bizarro World, which I wish it did. I don't think it's a location. And generally, I think Uzu didn't do that. Like, they didn't list
correct
the Daily Planet or the Batcave or Paradise Island or Atlantis. So they're keeping with the form. Nevertheless, it would have been nice to see it.
If I can jump in there, I did some research on it. So,
so I've been talking for all of 12 seconds.
Congratulations. So Bizarro himself appeared in Superboy number 68 in 1958, but that was a one-off. I didn't realize this. So he appears in Superboy, but it's a one-off. And apparently the newspaper strip premiered the more iconic adult version of Bizarro at the same time. So I find that fascinating that the Bizarro we all know actually came from the comics, or the cartoon strip, or the newspaper strip, which is great. And then the Bizarro's World doesn't premiere until 1960.
I did not know that.
I know. That's why I wanted to share it. It's interesting. And you try to stop me.
That's well. All right. Never mind. Okay. So it's perfectly fine. I don't mean to, you know, we're already kind of dinging on Kurt Swan a little early on and Chris Franklin shaking his fist. My only complaint is like Bizarro. I know that Bizarro got his own listing just a page earlier. So I can see why you don't make him the main character of this. But it just feels weird that like he's kind of on the periphery of this drawing when he's really, you know, it's called Bizarro. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little strange that like sort of the Batman and Green Lantern get kind of a bigger point of it. The reason that I always the thing I think about when I read anything involving Bizarro is I remembered years now. It's decades ago that Alan Moore pitched DC a miniseries set on Bizarro World. Because he wanted to explore the world because he was fascinated at the physics of it. Because he's like, what is it like living on the corner of the Bizarro world? What are the physics of that? And he wanted to explore all that. And DC turned him down, which is nuts, right? You're like, why would you turn down Alan Moore at like the height of his popularity? Right. But nevertheless, they did. But anyway, Bizarro World, an enduring concept in the Superman universe. I thought they were going to get close to Bizarro in the movie. They kind of did, but they never called him Bizarro, things like that. But I don't know. It's just one of the goofier elements of the Superman universe, but has stuck through like every iteration of Superman over the decades.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I will say we're on opposite sides about this entry. I absolutely love this entry. So I am here to celebrate this Kurt Swan and Carl Kiesel piece. I think it is so much fun. First of all, very intelligently, everything is at like, it's not quite 45 degree angle, but it's close. It's close to like a 45 degree angle. Everything is askew, which is a brilliant thing. I didn't even notice that at first. So it took me a while to figure that one out. That's brilliant from a layout perspective. You get the inset of the square planet is a great way to display it. It's a good usage of the space. I love like goofy Batman where he's like, I don't know where he's hitchhiking or like, oh, he's doing like, look at this guy. I don't know. He's got his thumb up, like pointing it off to the side with his goofy floppy ears, which I adore. And okay, you called him the Yellow Lantern. He's not actually the Yellow Lantern. He's called the Yellow Candle, and it is
right,
the dumbest.
There's a candle on his chest. Yep. There,
it is the dumbest concept, and I have loved it ever since I read this entry when I was a kid. The Yellow Candle ran out of power after 24 hours because he didn't have a lantern to charge it with, which I just found so funny as a kid, and I still do. I think it's a hoot. So I think this entry is super fun. It brings me a lot of joy. Now, I do have questions, though. Like, the Daily Planet building, it's got that, you know, odd-shaped globe on top of it. Shouldn't that globe be a square? You know,
right,
the
you would
big
think
ornament?
If it's opposite. Yeah, you would think.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was reading the entry, and it says that Superman himself reshape the world into
reshape
a square.
The planet. Yeah.
Which what is that about?
Superman makes so many decisions without consulting anybody, right? Whether it's Black Canary right. or Bizarre, he's real super dickery. Is like a whole thing. By the way, I know he's called Yellow Candle, but in the entry here, he's called Yellow Lantern.
Oh, is it really?
It says powers and weapons. Yeah. Bizarre Yellow Lanterns were similar to those of Green Lantern.
Weird.
So there you go.
Huh, okay. Brenda Pope. So whenever I think of Bizarro World, I always think of the Superpowers cartoon because they had later on, they did like a Bizarro Firestorm and a Bizarro Cyborg, which were so much fun. I just love those characters. So if you want more on Bizarro, I mean, obviously you can list like shows over Michael Bailey's Fortress of Baileytood Network. On Zoom, you can always Zoom's Done in One Wonders podcast, Wonder Show. Bizarro used to be a recurring character. Then you talk about him being everywhere. It's not just in every iteration of comics, but also in almost every media, even in Superman 4, you know, the Nuclear Man is, in theory, a version of Bizarro.
Yes.
Then you get Bizarros in the Superboy TV series, Lois and Clark, Smallville, Supergirl, Superman and Lois, Challenge of the Super Friends, obviously the Super Friends and Superpowers, the DC animated shows. It just goes on and on and on. Now, I do have a question for you. Like, the Challenge of the Super Friends is just burned into my mind rent-free forever. I assume the same as you.
Oh, absolutely.
Did it always strike you that Bizarro Superman just seemed a tad redneck with like his voice and the way he spoke?
No, I can't say I've ever.
Really?
I'm Solomon Grundy, certainly, but I don't know. I've never really thought about that.
All right, somebody back me up here. There was something about that Bizarro version of Challenge Super Friends that always sat with me like a little like he's a little bit from the hills, I think.
We'll have to get an expert in on this. Chris Franklin will have to consult us on this.
There we go. All right. Well, you ready to move on, buddy?
Absolutely.
All right. Next up is Colonel Computron. Boop, 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 boop. So from Who's Who issue number 5, artist is Carmen Infantino and Klaus Janson, which is interesting. Klaus Janson on top of Carmen Infantino. I think this is another attempt to take one of these golden or silver age artists and update him a bit. So Klaus Janson gives him a little bit of a lift, a little bit of an edge. And basically the story here is, this guy is Basil Nerblin. He creates this toy called Captain Computron. Not Captain, but not Colonel, but Captain. And then the toy manufacturer, a company called Wiggins Toy Company, steals the patent. So Basil does what any self-respecting toy inventor would do. He dons the costume similar to his toy, promotes himself from Captain to Colonel, becomes Colonel Computron. And he tries to kill the head of Wiggins Toy Company, but is foiled by the Flash multiple times. So here we see this drawing of this very chunky, very massive, what's supposed to be probably, I don't know, echoing Tron maybe is what we're supposed to be going for. I don't know. This was created in 1981, so it's right in that. I can't remember when Tron came out, so it's right in that
82,
zone.
I think.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. Well, he's very chunky. It's very silvery. He's supposed to look like he's made of computer parts of sorts. And it's supposed to look a little nondescript with sort of a blank face with just his mouth showing. And you've got that in the foreground with silver and blue. And then the surprint in red, you've got Nerblin, Basil Nerblin. Then you've got his wife, who's also a genius, and his daughter, who's a genius. And then you've got Colonel Computron trying to blast the Flash. So what do you think of the art here, buddy?
I like the artwork. I think Klaus Janson is a great inker for Carmen Infantino because I think you just spent a whole like hour ripping Carmine a new one over on From Empire to Jedi, and you know, yeah, during
you're not wrong.
In his later years, the work, you know, yeah. So I think Klaus Janson brings a grit to it and an energy to it that I don't think it necessarily had in the later years. I love this design. Like it's just goofy as all get out. And it's kind of funny. I think if he was just called Computron, it wouldn't be funny or goofy, but Colonel Computron, there's something about the alliteration or something that just makes it seem like, well, now he's like a mascot for like a tech company, like an electronics store, right? In the late 90s, the early 90s and stuff. And it's like, yeah, you might get up to 12K of RAM. You're like, wow, this is so exciting. this is an incredibly goofy character, but I love how it looks.
My only disappointment is the logo. I feel like the logo should have looked more computerish. This probably came from the comic based on the lettering of it, but still should have looked a little more. Now, a couple things to mention here. So did anything ring a bell about the toy company that he worked for?
No.
This Wiggins Toy Company has terrible hiring practices. This is the same toy company that hired Captain Boomerang. So, I mean, really, HR needs to be stepping up their game over at Wiggins Toy Company. It's really bad. Now, at the time of this writing, the actual identity of who Colonel Computron was unknown. It was either theorized it was either Basil, which they're correct, or his wife or his daughter, so that's why they're all in the surprint. And I think I've read this issue, so I think it's a bit of fun thing in there when you read it, and I wish it was in the surprint. They actually turned Barry Allen into an 8-bit computer character. You know, like it looks like he's from the Atari 2600.
Oh, that's great. That's cool.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to take a little bit of a different position for you. I think it's a fun design, and I applaud their efforts to jump in the computer craze in 1981. That's great. But I do feel like this does suffer a little bit of Carmen Infantino's style at the time. Like, the character looks fun and goofy in a kitschy kind of way. Like, I love it in that kind of way. But as far as, like, a serious threat, no, it's not. I'm sorry. But, like, you know, and by contrast, like, just a little time after this, a year or two, you know, Raphael Kiannon designs Bug and Bite. The another computer craze sort of bad guys, and I still think they look great. So I just now I will say this is I think the only Infantino pose where the hands aren't on hips. But
that's nice,
probably because he can't move his arms that way. I don't know.
Yeah, he probably can't flex his arms right the way he's. Yeah,
right.
He's 6'5", so it's like it's kind of funny because he looks sort of squat here, and then in the thing where he's zapping the Flash, he doesn't look that much taller, but obviously he's supposed to be this massive thing. Yeah. I like the little dots for eyes. Like he looks like little orphan Annie or something. I feel like the Flash has such a extensive rogues gallery that you can have a couple of goofs in there. You know, but I didn't call them Morts, by the way.
Oh, God. I want
to point that out. I didn't call them Morts. You can have a couple of the goofier ones, right? Thrown in. And that's what he is.
And it's good that they were trying to create even new villains for him in 81. So that's good.
Sure.
I do, when I look at it, though, I do hear the Tron music like, you know, kind of thing. Now, his first appearance is Flash number 304 in 1981. And I knew this, Rob. I knew this off the top of my head because that is the last issue of the Firestorm backups.
Right.
I lived in those comics growing up. So now, believe it or not, Colonel Computron, well, you probably do believe it, he's actually made it to live action. I don't know exactly because I didn't see this episode of The Flash, but apparently in The Flash TV show, they had some version of at least Basil Nerblin. I don't know that he – I don't know if he became Colonel Computron, but there was some version of him that appeared in The Flash TV show, of course.
I'm glad that's the part they kept was the Basil Nerblin name.
Or something. I mean, I don't even know that for sure. I only did peripheral research on that. Okay. I just thought, okay, Flash TV show, next.
So, all right, okay.
So boop, 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 boop.
Yeah, next up, Dead Man, drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name. Sean Myers is finally waking up here listening after his turkey comb. He's like, oh, Dead Man. Somebody say Dead Man. look, this is like we say with almost every JLGL piece, like this would be your presentation art for a Dead Man toy line or a Dead Man cartoon series or a Dead Man movie because it tells you everything you need to know. Right? It's beautifully rendered. I love his pose where he's sort of standing, yelling off into the heavens as he always did in like every story. He's always like, Ramakushna! He's always so mad and stuff like that. We see him before he gets shot. We see him at his origin moment where he's getting shot, flying off the trapeze. We see the side characters and we see a use of his powers as he is taking over somebody's body. All beautifully designed, all beautifully rendered. I mean, we've run out of superlatives for this guy, but it's like this is – and with the logo from his original series, Strange Adventures 206 is his first appearance, by the way. It's just – it's, you know, like Dead Man's not going to look any better than this.
It's amazing. It's a fantastic drawing. In fact, I loved it so much. It sounds weird to say, but it made me realize there's no Neil Adams in Who's Who. Like I'm looking at it.
No.
And it's not – it's different from Neil Adams, but you still get that vibe of Neil Adams, how the energy and the body and the physique of it and everything. And that's when I completely forgot that we never had a Neil Adams entry in here. But this is gorgeous. Actually, in fact, I'd rather have this entry here than a Neil Adams piece because I think it's such a complete, like you said, it tells the whole story.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
Great use of negative space that like the black turtleneck that he's got, Boston Brand's wearing, goes all the way down to the bottom. And that contrasts against the characters in front of it. JLGL's listings almost uniformly were so good that it made you think the character that he was rendering was a bigger deal than he was because he looked so amazing. You're like, oh, this guy must be like a huge star in the DCU. And you're like, no, not really. I mean, to this point, Dead Man never got his own series. He was about to get a miniseries, and he had that reprint series, I think, right around this time, the deluxe reprint series. But Deadman had not had a comic to his – he had only been like a backup feature all these decades. But you look at this, and you're like, oh, he's got to be like what one of their top 10 characters, right?
Right. And I will say, I mean, yeah, every GL piece is amazing. But even this one's a step above. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just really good. And now, this has nothing to do with JLGL, but as we like to say on the show, peripheral vision is overrated when you're in the superhero world. Because with that collar, he is never seeing what's to the left or the right of him. He's only seeing what's straight ahead. So I love his occupation, former circus aerialist and now wandering spirit. I hope to have the same job description at some point in my life. And so real quick, you mentioned the first appearance. You said 206. It's actually 205.
205, excuse me.
Well, it's interesting, though, because there's a reason for that of sorts. So when I looked him up, it says he was created by Arnold Drake and Carmen Infantino, which I was like, really? Like, that surprised me. I have always associated Neil Adams with Deadman, and I thought he was a creation of Neil Adams.
No.
Turns out that he took over Deadman on the second issue. Mm-hmm. So you said 206, which was accidental, but that's when Neil Adams took it over. So it's sort of interesting that Arnold Drake and Carmen Infantino only did the one issue, and from then on it was Neil Adams and the other guy. So who wrote it, who nobody remembers, including myself at the moment. But so, you know, he was part of the Hills Brothers Circus. I do wonder if the Hills Brothers Circus and the Haley Circus ever, like, showed up in the same town at the same time and started, like, fighting over who had the rights to sell popcorn and peanuts. Like, circus clowns going around with snapping, like, the Jets and the Sharks and everything.
I don't think that's how it works.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it does in my world. So
yeah, okay.
Then, it's kind of sad here. The origin of Deadman, I don't know a lot about Deadman. I know, like, the obvious stuff. You know, he takes over people's body. He shows up. But I've never really read any Deadman-centric stories. And it was very sad in here to learn that, you know, he was killed by someone from the League of Assassins. And it was just, like, it wasn't even, like, very specific. It was just, like, this guy, it was, like, I think it was a tryout or something to get in the League of Assassins. Like, he just just needed to kill somebody. And it's like, wow, man, poor Boston Brand took it hard for someone else. So, and another thing I found interesting, and this is clearly Neil Adams playing around with it, is that, you know, the League of Assassins are responsible for his death, but the League of Assassins don't premiere for like 3 years until after Deadman's created. So it's clearly one of those retroactive things, like Deadman gets killed, and then years later, Neil finally figures out how he dies, and it was a whole retroactive thing.
By the way, I just looked it up. The writer that took over was Carmen Infantino was listed as plotter, which is unusual, and Jack E. Miller as the scripter.
Okay.
Adams doing the artwork.
I was thinking his name was Miller. Well, I think Adams really contributed heavily to it, especially as the series went on. I think he became more of the driving force.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So here's the interesting thing. I don't know if – I didn't know this until I was doing some research. You mentioned, like, this is your pitch piece for a Deadman TV series. Do you know how close we've gotten to Deadman on the big screen and stuff?
I'm guessing by your question that we've gotten closer than I imagine.
Yes, much closer. So in 2003, it was in Deadman, a TV series was in development for TNT. Ultimately got shelved.
TNT.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember that. Then in 2011, I think TNT also was the original ones who optioned the Teen Titans TV series, if I remember right, too. But anyway, in 2011, CW hired the creator of Supernatural, which was a huge deal, to develop a Deadman TV series.
Oh, that I can say.
And more recently, Guillermo del Toro, he wants to make a Deadman movie.
Oh my God.
And I hope James Gunn is listening and just cutting a check for that to happen.
Yeah. Holy what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, oh, get hot. Whoa. I never heard that. Yeah. Yep. Are you kidding me?
Now that could have been. Oh my God. That could have been from a couple years ago. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if he's still interested or not.
I mean, to be fair, Guillermo del Toro attaches himself to many, many, many projects that never see the light of day. I mean, I think he gets excited and, you know, maybe some press person gets a little overexcited. He's had his name on a dozen movies that will never come to pass because he can only make one movie every so often. So, but nevertheless, that would be an unbelievable movie. We just saw his Frankenstein in the theater a couple of weeks ago. That would be amazing.
That's sort of like us at the network. We constantly have new podcast series ideas. All of us. We're like, ooh, I want to do, a podcast on X, Y, and Z. And it's like, oh, I'm never going to
I
get to
just don't
that.
have the time. But anyway, but we do will things into happening. So let's talk about this more. Guillermo del
That's
Toro's
right.
Dead Man. It might actually happen at that point.
Yep. All right. So
Wow.
for more on Dead Man, hope to see him on the big screen someday. Or he would show up in all kinds of stuff, like in the Justice League cartoons or Batman Brave and the Bold, Teen Titans Go, DC Nation Shorts, Sean Meyer's Dreams. I mean, he's in a lot of different places that you can find him, folks. I even had my Sean Meyer's joke in there before you said yours earlier. I wrote it a couple of days ago. I'm kind of disappointed you beat me to it. But anyway.
You
All
live and
right. Jeez. All right, let's do that randomizer.
beep 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 beep
Man, someone gave us some caffeine. All right. Oh, it's me. I'm up. Okay. I'm sitting here going like, why isn't Rob starting? Okay. So,
I'm
yes, because
staring at the damn entry. I'm waiting for you to talk.
I get to talk about the Marquis de Sade entry of the book. Oh, Lord, how did I get this one? Yes, we're here to talk about de Sade, who is a kid's comic book character, literally inspired and named for the Marquis de Sade, which is super twisted. Anyway. This is a drawing by Jack Kirby and Greg Thigpen, and in the foreground you got Desaad in his purple cloak or a magenta cloak with his greasy hair and his snarling face coming at you with his arms reached out like he's like a boogeyman trying to reach you, one arm up, one arm in front of him. Some pretty cool foreshortening going on there and skinny, creepy fingers. Then in the green surprint in the background, you've got a close-up of his face. You've got him torturing someone, possibly Mr. Miracle, Scott Free, maybe, when he was still a kid. I'm not sure. Then you've got him, sort of being, subservient to Darkseid. So what do you think of the art here, buddy?
It's good. Greg Theakston is one of, I don't know, I think I've always said Mike Royer was my favorite Kirby inker, but Greg Theakston is a close second. I think especially because as we saw, Kirby's work in the 80s got like kind of looser and more abstract. And I think Greg Theakston kind of like reins him in a little bit. I dare say, we're reining in the king, but nevertheless, I love the pose. I like that he's kind of, it looks like he's doing a little like soft shoe. Like he's, like you kind of talk about Sharks and the Jets, kind of like do 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 do. By the way, the guy that's getting the head his head zapped is what's the Forever People guy that was the cowboy, Seraphin or something?
Seraphin or something like that. Yeah,
That
a little
I
bit.
think that's Seraphin because he looks like he has like a neckerchief around his neck. I think that's what Seraphin is. I think.
He did first premiere in Forever People, so you're probably right.
I think that's, yeah. And of course, the logo was the logo that appeared on the Superpowers toy because this guy got a Superpowers action figure.
Oh, wow. Now, which would have hit the shelves first, though? Was he in wave two, wave
He
three?
was
I don't know.
wave two. He was wave two.
So it would be about the same year. So
Yeah.
I bet you that logo was probably used in a New Gods related comic in
Oh,
some
yeah.
way
I'm
or
just
another.
saying that it got, it was so established that they put it on a toy. For Pete's sake. So yeah, I
That's
mean,
great.
he's just I like that bottom inset panel of him kind of sniveling up to Darkseid. He's
Yeah.
kind of like he's like doing a Smithers to Darkseid's Mr. Burns, which is
Yeah.
perfect. So I for a character I never cared that much about, it's a great entry.
So I got a question for you. His hair, like he's got, I don't even know how to describe it. It looks black and oily and greasy to me. Like, how would you describe that hair?
Well, he's got it's like a, it's kind of like a Superman spit curl, except it's just sort of dangling. It's not curled up. And instead of the hair being kind of all strands, it's kind of congealed into these little tendrils, and that's what's dropping down. So it's I like his angry face too. Like,
I always just think it's like a greasy mess, is what I imagine. Like, it looks to me like he hasn't been washed in weeks. And, with that robe, I imagine he smells pretty bad,
Well,
actually.
I would imagine Apocalypse is a pretty rank place in
That's
general.
probably true. It's probably true. So he is 5'11 and only 152 pounds. So I have to ask Rene Auberjonois, what have you been eating? Because, my friend, you need to pack on some calories, drink a milkshake or something, buddy. So the story here, they don't really give an origin for him. They talk more about what he's done since he started partnering with Darkseid. Basically, he's a designer of weapons and devices for torturing and killing. Also, he takes perverse pleasure in using technology to experience the emotions of those he's tortured. He's even addicted to it, which, weirdly enough, that's the same origin as Brett Young here on the network. But anyway, so he gets ordered to kill the queen of Apocalypse, and so he I'm sorry, he gets ordered by the queen of Apocalypse to poison Darkseid's bride. Then in turn, he obeys Darkseid and murders that queen, thus putting Darkseid in power. So he's actually responsible for Darkseid's rise to power. And he's obviously always Darkseid's lackey, but then when Darkseid ever gets pissed at him, he uses the Omega beams and disintegrates him. So something I imagine Rob wishes he could do to me quite often.
I've never thought that in my life.
Well, and I'm not your lackey, so that worked out.
No, you will that too.
First appearance, Forever People number 2, Lucky Guy. If you want more of Desaad, you can find him on this. For me, he'll always be Desaad from the Super Friends and the Super Powers cartoon. Again, Rene Auberjonois is Desaad's voice to me. He was also in Superman the Animated Series and Justice League, and somehow he's made it into Smallville and Young Justice and Justice League Action. He was in the Kite Man animated series, Rob.
Wow.
Tons of animated movies, and apparently he made an appearance in Zack Snyder's Justice League that was on HBO. I've never seen it, so
yes,
I have no idea.
Yes, that is true. I watched all 7 hours of that, yes.
Oh, good Lord. Wow. You lucky guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right, well.
Oh, before I'm sorry. Let me go undo all that booping
because
I just want to mention one thing. It doesn't matter how I watch it. Have you ever seen the Mortal Kombat movie, the one from the 90s?
Actually, I have not.
Okay, I watched something online that featured clips from it, and apparently there's this big kind of like CGI creature that they fight. I've never seen the movie, but they showed this clip, and the creature is voiced by Frank Welker. And no. They showed the clip, and he's just doing the Darkseid voice. There's no difference between him. And so I paired you, and they show this creature. He's like, oh, and it just sounds like, I can't do it. You can do it. But it's like, yeah. I was like, wow, Frank Welker was supposedly the man of 1,000 voices, but he was just kind of like, I'll just do Darkseid again. It's fine. Nobody's going to know. So I thought you'd appreciate that since we're talking about Darkseid. So.
That makes me very happy.
There you go. Perfect. See, I can't even remotely do it. So, okay. next up is Green Arrow of Earth 1. I already mentioned him in the in-stock trades segment. Now, here...
Actually,
this,
technically, that was Green Arrow from Earth 2.
Well, that's true. I mean, the Green Arrow concept. But yes, this Green Arrow was given a retroactive first appearance in Adventure Comics number 260. And I
no.
50, 250, this, excuse me.
I have lots to say about that, so keep going.
Okay. Now, as far as I remember, that's just a random point. I don't think that's not a new origin because he has basically the same origin as what do you mean no?
He has a completely different origin.
He does? I thought he had the same one.
I was gonna shut up and let you talk, but you're speaking lies. You're speaking lies.
The Green Arrow of Earth 2 didn't get sent to an island and became a whole thing the way the Green Arrow of Earth 1 does?
There's literally another entry in this book that tells the origin of Green Arrow from Earth 2.
I didn't read that. So anyway, this is drawn by Mike Grell, of course, because Mike Grell.
Wait, let's go back to his first appearance. I told you I had a lot to say about
okay,
it.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
So, yes, it credits the first appearance of the Silver Age, or Earth 1 version of Green Arrow, as Adventure Comics number 250 from 1958. Makes no freaking sense. They just randomly picked an issue. Yeah. I mean, the only thing notable about it is that Jack Kirby took over the Green Arrow strip at that point. The story is the Green Arrows of the World, which was a blatant ripoff of the Batman of all nations, which is all Green Arrow would do is rip off Batman. However, what would have made a lot more sense is if they just went 6 issues forward to issue 256, which is where he did get the Silver Age origin, all about going to the island and all those trappings that the origins we all know of Green Arrow actually comes from issue 256. He had a completely different origin in the Golden Age. So why they didn't pick 256, I don't know. It's weird.
That is very odd. But nevertheless, it's drawn by Mike Grell. We see him canoodling with Black Canary in her one uniform that nobody liked.
It's the Jazzercise costume.
Yeah.
I love it.
Okay. Well, all right. We see him without his mask. We see him using his bow and arrow, and then we see him on the island, and it's beautifully drawn. And he's got a great logo. I love his Green Arrow logo. My only criticism of this piece at all is that it's not an action pose. Like, he's just sort of standing there with the bow and arrow. Now, I know that the space that he's given, Mike Grell was given, is very narrow, so he probably doesn't have a lot of room. And we get some action poses in the short print, as I mentioned. But that's the only minor criticism that I have, is that he's just sort of standing there. Nevertheless, he's always been one of my favorite characters. When I was a kid, my 5 favorite DC heroes were Aquaman, of course, Batman, Green Arrow, Hawkgirl, and Plastic Man. Those are my 5. And that's why I love Justice League so much, is because it had 4 of the 5. So he's always been my favorite, one of my favorites. He's probably my single favorite Mego doll because he looks so good. Like, Mego did an amazing job on him. I even had the Arrow car, if I remember correctly. So I've always dug this character. He gets this new uniform in Brave and the Bold number 85. There's no retelling of an origin or updating an origin. They just give him kind of that. Neil Adams and Denny O'Neil were the ones that kind of made him more of like the urban hunter, man of the people kind of thing. So it was sort of a new direction for the character, but he was already a member of the Justice League by that point. But this is the look that everybody's familiar with. It's this particular outfit.
This costume is absolutely killing it. I just love this costume. It is so cool looking. Now, I know you said he's just standing there. I mean, you're not wrong, but he is at least notched an arrow. I mean, he is sort of like getting ready to shoot. So there's a little bit of there.
Yeah.
That logo is just damn amazing. That is such a great logo. It's the one where the bar on A is an arrow going to the O in arrow, which is a target. It's just really incredibly well done. Now, I started thinking about this. I'm like, okay, Mike Grell, Green Arrow, no brainer, right? But then I started thinking, I'm like, wait a minute, Longbow Hunters is after this.
Yes, it is.
So I had to look it all up. I mean, maybe everyone else knows this and I just didn't. But so he started drawing the Green Arrow strip in Action Comics all the way back in 1974. And then he ended up drawing when Green Lantern and Green Arrow, you know, it was there for a long time, the big Neil Adams one, then it went away. And when it came back, Mike Grell actually was the one drawing it in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't realize that. But when you get to this entry, which is this is from issue number 9 of Who's Who, so it's late in 1985, he hadn't touched the character in like 7 years. So it's sort of interesting he came back for it. And it would be, as I said, another 2 years before we get to the Longbow Hunters anyway. So it was just nice to see Mike Grell doing this piece. I really like it. Now I do have a question for you because you mentioned, you know, the changes to the character. It's like, I don't know enough about Ollie's. I mean, I know his big story point ideas, but I haven't read them myself. So like, when does he get that social consciousness? When does it happen? Is that during the Green Lantern, Green Arrow stories? Cause like, I know he already has it at that point. Did it happen before that?
It happened with that issue where he gets the new costume.
Brave and the Bold.
Yeah. It's that Brave and the Bold 85 where they basically just all of a sudden turn him into kind of this really man of the people street fighter kind of character. That was really it was the late 60s, and I think that was Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams wanting to give him a little more cultural relevance, because before that he was just kind of a generic character. I mean, he would no offense, but it's kind of like in those early Justice Leagues, every character talks exactly the same. You could give everybody the same bit of dialogue, and Green Arrow was one of those. And then all of a sudden after this he becomes really opinionated and all this, and you know, they made hay out of that, and it's basically the characters remain that way to this day. And isn't it amazing to think, right? You and I grew up in a time when Green Arrow was not a marquee character, right? He had a miniseries, which was great. Mike W. Barr, Trevor Von Eden, but that was it. He was always a backup guy. And now there's an entire like TV universe called the Arrowverse. Cause he was the central figure. That is just, you know, that's insane. If you had said in 1985, oh, this character is going to become like the hub of a many million dollar television event, you know, that's going to run for 15 years, you'd be like, that, what are you talking about? That's insane. And yet here we are.
Let's be fair. I mean, a lot of it is owed to Stephen Amell's abs. I mean, that's we do owe a big thing of gratitude to that. So
absolutely. But it's just, you think about how famous this character is now.
I know.
Right?
It's crazy. Yeah. My 85-year-old dad knows who Green Arrow is. So that's nuts. So there's a couple things in the entry, which I think are kind of funny. It mentions in here that Speedy now works independent of Green Arrow. What it doesn't say is that, yes, he does, because Ollie's a terrible father. And then one thing that it specifically calls out with the arrows is he does not shoot arrows to kill opponents. And all I can ever think is like, then why are they so freaking sharp, dude? Why don't you shoot blunt arrows? Like, you know, Mike Grell makes a point of showing how sharp the arrows are in this drawing, which, you know, as you get into the Longbow Hunters and stuff, he does start, you know, I don't know if he kills people, but he's definitely using the points to make his point. Now, if you want more on Green Arrow, you could listen to the Warlord Worlds podcast, where they cover a lot of that with Mike Grell. The Smallville TV show had a Green Arrow in there for several seasons. Obviously, as you said, the Arrow TV show, which led to the Arrow universe. Then, he was in Super Friends for an episode. He had a great...
I should have mentioned that. Yes, that was a big deal to me when he showed up in Super Friends.
He had a great presence in Justice League Unlimited. He had a huge presence in Batman Brave and the Bold, which was super fun because they went for more of the Silver Age look. Yeah, Justice League Action and Young Justice and animated movies. It just goes on and on and on. And anyway, he's everywhere now, which is just phenomenal.
One last thing I want to mention. Now, he's Oliver Queen, of course. I can't think of another Oliver in the DCU. I'm sure there is one. I'm done making declarative statements. There are no more Olivers in the DC universe. There's probably another one. I just can't think of one. But it's since the last Who's Who, you've adopted a dog. Now, is he Oliver or is he Ollie?
His name is Oliver.
Oliver. Yep. Okay.
Right. Now, the name came with the dog. I can't claim to have given him that, but hey, I mean, I love the connection between Oliver Queen and that, so that's fantastic. I hadn't even thought of that till someone else pointed it out for me.
There you go.
All right. Well, we're ready to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye, Oliver Queen. But surprisingly, we will be talking about you again in just a few minutes. Up next, we're going to talk about Kanjar Row. From Who's Who, issue number 12. Art is by Murphy Anderson. You've got, it's kind of a fun stance. There's a little bit of energy to it. He's sort of kind of going off to the side. He's got a giant grin on his face with his creepy insectoid, you know, multifaceted eyes. He's holding his little control rod with lots of little energy coming off of it. And then he's got his other hand out kind of going like, ta-da! And he's pink skinned with his blue bodysuit kind of costume. Then in the surprint, a red surprint, you've got him smashing the gong of power thing. And you've got a close up of his face. And you've got his super creepy sort of Viking rowing boat going through space. So what do you think of the drawing here, buddy?
It's nice. I love the bug faced portrait.
Yeah.
In the main image, you don't really get that. He just looks kind of just slightly buggish, but he just kind of looks like a dude. But then you see the portrait and you're like, oh no, he actually does have like an insect face with insect eyes. So that's really terrific. I really like that a lot. I'm not making declarative statements. I can't think of that many Murphy Andersons where he's inking himself, where he's either inking his own pencils or he's penciling but not inking. But here he's doing both. You mentioned in the surprint, there's the reproduction of his first appearance in Justice League of America number 3, where he is making the JLAers row through this thing. But for a second, I was like, oh, wait, isn't Green Arrow in there? But no, this is JLA number 3. This is one issue before Green Arrow joined the team. So no, he's not there. But yeah, didn't they bring him back in JLI and he was like a super badass, right? Or is that?
No, that was Despero.
Well, I know they did it to Despero, but they didn't. You know what? They did it in the 90s series, JLA.
Oh,
they brought him back and he was like a super killer in that one. Yeah. Okay.
And it would make sense. I mean, this is a character I think that screams necessary update, which is fine. And also, I mean, kind of his whole shtick is he's a slaver, which really isn't kind of like a little icky or a lot of icky. But I do love his cosmic boat. I mean, it's terrible, right, that he traps people and makes them row through space in this boat. But I just love the way it looks. It's just got this really cool look that I dig. So his shtick is he was a planetary dictator. And he was at war with 3 other planets in the same solar system, including one planet that was led by another dictator, Dr. Ange's favorite, Hyathus. So
I thought you were going to say Dr. Zinza.
No, Lord. So Kanjar Row, he comes to Earth. He paralyzes the entire Earth's population in an attempt to get the JLA to fight his battles for him against his other 3 planets. You know, there's days where I wish I could paralyze the entire planet's population. But anyway. Obviously, the JLA beat Kanjar Row, and he's returned to battle them again and again and again, as well as Adam Strange. Now, there's one story that's out, they spent a lot of time outlining here, where Kanjar Row takes over Adam Strange's adoptive homeworld of Ran. Meanwhile, his enemy Hyathus takes over the Hawks' world of Thanagar. So war breaks out between Ran and Thanagar. Once again, the JLA step in to help stop the war. Now, can you imagine a story less interesting than one with Hyathus, Kanjar Row, and Ran versus Thanagar? Yawn. So, he has no powers, but he's extremely cunning, and he uses a lot of advanced tech, which is why he's been such a formidable foe for so long. As you mentioned, his first appearance goes all the way back to Justice League of America number 3. Interesting character. I mean, I love the look of him. He's sort of fun. I just like the Silver Age campiness of him. You know, I can't take him seriously, but it's super fun.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want more of him, you can check out the Justice League cartoon. He appears in there. He appears in Batman Brave and the Bold. He's in some of the Green Lantern animated movies. And here's a flash fact for you. Kanjar Row, The Shadow, and me all share the same nose. So there you go. Who knew?
Wow.
More you know, folks. More you know.
Oh my. all right. Next, I'm just going to move on from that. So next up is Kung, who got a half page He first appears in Wonder Woman, first appeared in Wonder Woman number 237. Now, that was during that book's run where we were back in World War II. These are the adventures of the World War II Wonder Woman. So he is a World War II character. He later on tangled with the All-Star Squadron, which, of course, is it's not a retcon, but it's, you know, definitely kind of reinserting him into the team that didn't exist when he was originally created. Now, it mentions that he died in battle. But then it undoes all that by saying, well, thanks to the crisis in on Infinite Earths, who knows? Maybe he's not dead. Like, well, all right. You really kind of undercut the drama of all that then. he can transform into any kind of animal, and we see him turning into a tiger there. It's drawn by Dennis Cowan and Dick Giordano. So for a tiny piece with not a lot of room, I think it's a nice piece. We see the nice big close-up of him. I like the little pose he's doing. His uniform is kind of cool, and we see him with his power. So, you know, certainly not one of the more famous Wonder Woman villains, although, you know, that's not saying much because she really didn't have that many villains. She really didn't. I'm sorry. Yeah. When Dr. Psycho is like in your top five, you're really, you know, kind of straining. nevertheless, it's a nice drawing because who doesn't like Dennis Cowan and Dick Giordano makes everybody well.
Yeah, a lot of times a half-page drawing is like they pack a lot of art in there and it got reduced down too much. This one, I feel like they knew the size because it looks a little too sketchy. Now, Dennis Cowan's going to do it kind of sketchy, but Dick Giordano's normally adds a lot to it. So I feel like it could have used a little more detail. That's just me. The thing most embarrassing to me, though, about this is on the same page, the other half entry is Kulak, who was just in some of the JSA issues we covered on my JSA in the 90s podcast. And yet myself and pretty much everyone that listened could not remember this guy at all. So it's sort of embarrassing to see him there. So you mentioned him dying. So like a couple different things. So yeah, he dies in the Wonder Woman issue. But then because Roy Thomas can't leave anything alone, yes, he incorporates him into the All-Star Squadron. So he actually meets the All-Star Squadron before he meets Wonder Woman because you got to get it in the right order or he doesn't die. Now, I would say about him that the Crisis sort of undoing statement, this came out of Who's Who issue 13. So Crisis has just ended. So at this point, they just have no idea what's going to happen with anything. As far as I can tell, he stayed dead. So I don't think they undid it so much as they're like, we don't know, kind of thing.
Well, it just feels a little like, you know, it'd be kind of cool to have somebody actually die and then one sentence later, well, maybe not. Well, all right, then why'd you even bring it up? You know, kind of, okay.
Now, I have never read these Wonder Man issues. However, I am sure with 100% confidence that the Bronze Age absolutely handled his character's Japanese heritage with cultural sensitivity. I'm sure it was really well handled. Yeah, okay. So anyway, he appeared in two issues of Wonder Woman, those handful of issues in All-Star Squadron, has a few other appearances here and there. Then, believe it or not, there is another character named Kung, who is in the Wonder Woman books in 2007, and he is apparently the spiritual successor of Kung. So, and if you want to hear more about this character, I don't know of anywhere specific, but I'm just going to guess, you know, maybe Diablo Frank's Diana Prince, the new Wonder Woman podcast, maybe, or A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast. I mean, that it should be in there, I would assume. But yeah, he's kind of a footnote to history that nobody really remembers.
I have to say, I read those Wonder Woman issues, and they're not bad. They're fun. They're fun.
All right. Ready to move on?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Boop, 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 boop. Up next is Multi-Man. From Who's Who, issue number 16, art by Chuck Patton and Larry Malstead. So you've got a, quite frankly, ridiculous image of Multi-Man in the foreground. It's this giant, I mean, muscles upon muscles here within a very tight blue tunic and briefs, then red gloves, red boots, giant red-winged collar, red belt, and then a ridiculously oversized head with pointy ears and a smile like he's... It looks like Timothy Dalton's face. If you just look at the face, it looks like Timothy Dalton without the head. But anyway, so in this print, you've got a close-up of his face in sort of a green color before he transformed. You've got him transforming into a bird creature. You have him in giant size with the Challengers of the Unknown giving him the smackdown. So what do you think of this image, buddy?
Well, it's Chuck Patton. That's great, right? And getting Chuck Patton to draw this ridiculous character is really, you know, a silk purse out of a sow's ear and that kind of thing. There is no ungodly reason this character has this much of a history. It's just not necessary. I love that the team he's on is the League of Challenger Haters, which is like That's like a name for your team that you're like, look, we'll come up with a better name later. Let's just a placeholder. Let's just call ourselves the League of Challenger Haters, and then we'll come up with something cooler later. No, it's the League of Challenger Haters. Like, okay, all right, that's fine.
It's like someone looked at the Superman Revenge Squad and says, I want to do something like that, but I'm not sure what.
Except not as cool. yeah. This guy is so goofy, I'm surprised Ange doesn't love him, because Ange Ange really loves a lot of the real, you know, I don't want to use the word, you know what I mean. Just
Christian's just waiting for you to use it.
Yeah. But nevertheless, yeah, incredibly goofy. Why is he so ripped? Why is he showing so much skin? I feel like he should team up with Hector Hammond and what other characters do they have?
The leader.
Like giant heads. He's Marvel, but like what other DC guy? Whatever DC guys have like giant heads.
Well, for clothes, he shops at the same tailor as Vartox. So
yes, there's a lot. My man is ripped. If women can get over the giant dome, he might do well with the ladies because he's pretty ripped.
So I podcasted about this guy off and on for 8.5 years on my Justice League show, and I never knew he had a real name. So I like Duncan Pramble, no clue. Never heard
great
of that
name.
Before.
That's a great Duncan Pramble is a fantastic name.
So the deal is he was this archaeological it's a very difficult word to say, folks. Archaeological assistant on a mission, and the Challengers of the Unknown happened to be there. And this guy, Duncan, ends up stealing this ancient formula and is transformed into Multi-Man. And it basically gives him these powers that every time he dies, he is reborn with new superpowers. So kind of like the Resurrection Man. And he battled the Challengers of the Unknown many, many times. And he's always defeated and ends up getting imprisoned in their mountain headquarters. Now let that sink in for a minute. The Challengers maintained a prison for supervillains in their headquarters. Like, what the hell, man? Like, who fed these prisoners when the Challengers were away on some long mission? Like, did they have prison guards? Like, was this OSHA approved? You know, it's just there's so many questions here. I think we need Mike Atchison to chime in here as our prison expert on our feelings on this, because I'm conflicted. Mike, this doesn't sound legitimate. It doesn't sound reasonable. I mean, come on.
I mean, the DCU didn't worry about those legal niceties, you know.
That's right. Superman had it like a prison floating in the air. I mean, like, you know, whatever that Superman Island thing was.
The JLA put the Secret Society of Supervillains in a stasis cube for like decades with no food, no bathroom. There's the five of you. Enjoy forever. Yeah. No, it's a lot of that.
It's terrible. So anyway, Multi-Man later on, years later, ends up in the JLI as a supporting humor character in the Injustice League. And they added one of the side effects of these multi-powers is he had multiple emotions where he would have these horrible mood swings, which was super funny, but probably not very sensitive to mental health issues. But anyway, first appearance is Challengers of the Unknown, issue 14 in 1960. If you want more on him, you can listen to the JLI podcast. He did fight the Doom Patrol one time, so I feel like they talked about on Waiting for Doom, but I can't remember if that's accurate or not. So that's the super buff Vartox cousin Multi-Man. All right. From the insane to the whoa lady, Onyx from Who's Who issue number 17 by artist Jerome K. Moore and Del Barris. And let me just say, wow, this entry is astonishing. Just blows me away. She is super hot, super sexy. Illustratedly, it just knocks it out of the park. I mean, Jerome K. Moore, you would expect that anyway. But so she is standing there in this really super cool black and white ensemble. I mean, it's super 80s. There's no denying that.
Yeah.
But I don't care. I'm an 80s guy. So it hits all the right buttons with the cape and the different armor and the studs and the giant fold of her boots. And it just looks awesome. She's got really, really big hair and her tiara, which, by the way, a message for her. Luke Cage called and he wants his tiara back. Then in the Serpent, we've got a very close-up shot of her beautiful face. We see all kinds of martial arts weapons like a shuriken and a katana and nunchucks and a sai. It's like the whole Ninja Turtles represented right there. Then you see her shooting an arrow at the bottom with some monks. You see her fighting with Green Arrow alongside him as they're taking out some punks. And it's just, wow, hell of an entry. I hope you would agree.
Oh, yeah, it's beautifully drawn by Jerome K. Moore and really nice inks by Del Barris. Like, he really brings a nice line to all the detail. I would say that this is like a George Perez Teen Titans costume. It's that it's got too many design elements, maybe. to kind of be, you know, maybe simplified just a touch, but it is a really cool uniform. The logo I don't get, like that O.
It's an onyx. It's the stone, an onyx.
Okay. It looks like an egg to me. You know, it just doesn't look like that. But it is beautifully drawn. She first appeared in Detective Comics 546, which was like the Green Arrow backup stories. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's really nice. It's a really, really nice drawing. I read those issues. I don't remember much about her. And I don't think she ever appeared past those stories. Did she?
Yep. Okay. So she's created by Joey Cavallari and Jerome K. Moore, as you said, for those Green Arrow backups in Detective Comics. She ends up in 11 issues of Green Arrow, of those Detective backups. It continues all the way right up until 1986, when basically the post-crisis Batman kicks in. Denny O'Neil takes over the book, and Green Arrow's out.
Right.
So she didn't really show up for a long – you're right. She didn't show up for a long time until after you were out of comics, which is why you didn't know. She shows up in the 1990s in a big Batman crossover called War Games – which, for anyone that's read War Games, that is not necessarily a good thing. It is not a well-beloved crossover. But altogether, shockingly, she has about 40 appearances, which I was really surprised about. Because
that's good.
For me, I don't know this character at all. Like, I've never read those Green Arrow stories. I never read War Games. I don't know. Like, she is an unknown character to me. But this drawing, as you said, a lot of it is the inks. Now that I think about it, you're right. The inks just really bring it out. It's incredible. So she has this – at the time of this writing, she has this very mysterious past. Even her real name's a mystery. She's running for her life. She ends up at a place called The Sanctuary, which is a monastery outside of Star City. There, she's trained in the martial arts. She becomes proficient at it. And then the master who runs the sanctuary, he dies. So she follows his last request to seek out Green Arrow. Together, they protect the sanctuary, and she becomes a supporting character in the Green Arrow strip. Now, at the time of this entry, though, that had been several years before this, and apparently she had more recently been spotting living behind a record store called Sounds Okay in Star City, which does not sound like a great way to end up. She's a martial arts master. She's also a master with the bullwhip. So pretty cool stuff. So are those Green Arrow backups worth reading?
I remembered liking them. I was buying Detective Comics at the time. I was buying it for Batman, obviously, but I remembered they weren't bad. I mean, I just said I really loved Green Arrow, so it was fun reading him in solo adventures. But yeah, this is Jerome K. Moore is just underrated, right? Underrated artist. The amount of detail and kind of illustrative quality he brought to things. And I mean, of course, famously, in nerd circles, he was the guy tapped to do the sequel Aquaman miniseries.
Yep.
To the Greg Hamilton series, and then the whole book got canceled. And there are pencils available of some of those pages, and they're absolutely stunning. So that's a giant loss. Yeah, this is really for a character. I know I've said a lot of times I like action poses, and here we don't see her doing an action pose. She's just standing there, but. It looks really – I like the fists down, and the uniform is really cool. It's a really great piece.
If you want to have some fun, first of all, follow Jerome K. Moore on Facebook. He posts cool stuff all the time, so I really love everything he posts. Then also, if you want to have some fun, go to like one of those websites that has all the comic covers and just stroll through the 1990s DC Star Trek comics, because he did a zillion of those covers, and they're all amazing. He does like Star Trek Next Generation, also classic Trek covers. They're just gorgeous, just stunning covers of Star Trek. So it'll evoke so much Star Trek love in you just to look at his covers. He also did a bunch of stuff for Ultraverse. I mean, he's done a ton of stuff that I love looking at. So if you want more of Onyx, you could she might get covered by Batman Nightcast someday. I'm not really sure. Or the Overlooked Dark Knight, or you could look for her in my dreams. So there we go.
Oh, jeez.
made an impression.
Next up is the Privateer, or just Privateer here.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He was, of course, formerly a Manhunter. He first appeared as that character in first issue special number 5. Then he first appeared as the Privateer in Justice League of America number 143. Then he became the Star Czar. In Justice League of America 149, I honestly don't think this character requires that level of detail in terms of his first appearances. We mentioned him on Who's Who not that long ago because
yes, we did.
In the issue where he gets revealed that he's a Manhunter, it's an unusual page in that it's just a face with a ton of text, but it's typeset because there was so much text, they just decided to make it typeset. It just sticks out as very unusual. He was a character that appeared in JLA during the Steve Englehart run. During the last couple issues, and there was this whole runner that the JLA loved him and was thinking about making him the newest member, and that sent Red Tornado, as he was wont to do, into the spasms of insecurity because he was like, you know, I just rejoined. I keep blowing up and I keep rejoining and I'm worried that this guy's going to outshine me. And then it ends up being the Red Tornado is the one that reveals that he is actually a bad guy and he's a manhunter. I think he looks really cool, but you know, the whole, when he becomes the villain and he's a former manhunter, all that stuff kind of like gums up the character a bit. I just think it would have been cool if he was just this guy that looked like a privateer.
So we've been talking about this guy a lot on this show over recent episodes because we talked about the Manhunters in a recent one.
Yeah.
And Frank's the one who figured it out for me. Like I asked you about this character. Like I said, you know, in my mind, he was supposed to be a big deal in the DC Justice League history. And you assured me, no, not really.
No, not really.
Footnote. But in my mind, he got built up. And it's all this Manhunter, Privateer, Star Czar, which then leads to Millennium, which leads to the Manhunter ongoing series, which is about Mark Shaw, which is where all this got conflated. And it made me think that all this was a bigger deal than it actually is. And here, it's like the universe, by putting this character in Who's Who review this time, it's like the universe is still trying to reinforce that this is important, and I know it's not. So, and it, as you said, the backstory, it's so complicated.
Yeah.
You know, first he's a manhunter, then he finds out they're alien robots, then he becomes the Czar Czar, then he pretends to be the privateer because he wants to betray the jail. Like, what? Now, go forward to the 1990s, and I love the Manhunter series that Mark Shaw headlined in there. But it's not so much because of Mark Shaw, but it's because John Ostringer, Kim Yale, and Doug Rice put together a fantastic series, which was a ton of fun. So I loved that. Now, one of the things in the personal data, I don't know if you noticed or not, his height is 5'11 and one half, which is sort of strange. We don't – I don't want to say it's the only time it ever happened because Isamu will tell me I'm wrong, but it's not
often. Unusual for sure. Yeah.
It's not often that you see a half listed.
Who the hell cares, right? Whatever.
Exactly. So did we say the artist, Stan Walken?
No, Bob I didn't Smith? Say Stan Walken, Bob Smith. Again, okay. I love this. Like, this guy's cool. Like, you could see him teaming up with Batman and Green Arrow. Like, that would be a really cool thing. But, yeah, they just gum him up with all this other stuff. And then he becomes this villain and yada, yada, yada. And it's, you know, it's more than – and you see there's a nice profile of him looking kind of severe there. We see him with Batman and, you know, and punching Flash and stuff like that. So all this is cool, but it just – I don't know. Like, it would be cool if they just had another character become privateer and just look like this. Because I like his outfit. He's got the Buccaneer boots.
Yeah.
Again, it's something Sean Myers is excited about. And he's got the épée, I believe it's called, right? That type of sword. And he's an eye patch, you know, another kind of unusual detail. He's really cool looking. And then just way, way too much other nonsense.
Well, the swashbuckling is super fun. I do love that they say he doesn't need the eye patch and both his eyes work. But anyway, the swashbuckling looks great. Then the Serpent, to be specific, it's the Manhunter punching Flash, and then later it's Star Czar kicking Superman or whatever. So, but then you get him like doing the, I don't know what you call it, like when you put one hand down and you like summer or you pull, it's a gymnastics term where you lift off from one hand, you do that sliding. It's the top left hand image. What am I trying to say here?
I don't know. I'm not sure what, you know.
Okay. Anyway, it's a great looking piece. I mean, Stan Walk and Bob Smith have done a fantastic job with this piece. It makes the character look so much cooler than he is. So yeah, it looks great. So if you want more on this character, you can listen to the Starman Manhunter Adventure Hour podcast by Aaron Had Moss. Then perhaps someday there'll be a Millennium podcast by a good friend of ours. And then I'm contractually obligated to say blah, 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 Event Leviathan, blah, blah, blah. There you go, Ange. Okay. Up next, boo, 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 the entry Rob didn't read, Speedy of Earth 2. From Who's Who, issue 21, art by Eric Schanauer, and it is gorgeous. Just gorgeous. I mean, I've always liked Eric Schanauer's art, but to tap him to draw a Golden Age, and really he draws it more Silver Age style, but either way, to draw a Golden Age, Silver Age style character looks fantastic. You've got Speedy, who's got in the foreground, and he's very young. I mean, he looks like he's about 9 years old. He's got on his red outfit, and he's got like one leg propped up on nothing really. And then he's got the bow and arrow above his head, and he's got this giant smile on his face. And then you got the green Serpent. You've got a close-up of Roy Harper's face. You've got him learning how to shoot the bow and arrow. You've got him with Oliver Queen. They're shooting arrows together. Then you've got him as a centaur, which we'll talk about. It's just a great looking piece. What do you think about it?
Oh yeah, I'm a fan of Eric Schanauer, and it's great. It's a very childlike pose. It's a very
Yeah.
little kid pose, playing with a bow and arrow. And I like the portrait of him. Again, the use of the negative space down at the bottom, and he looks like a boy. He looks like a small boy. He's built like a small boy. He's skinny and he's tiny. He's not just a small man with like a weird childhood face that some artists tend to render. No, it's terrific. It really is. It first appeared in More Fun Comics 73 along with Green Arrow, and he had, I think he's basically in every issue that Green Arrow ever appeared in. And he was a member of the Seven Soldiers of Victory instead of Aquaman. Don't get me started about that. But no, beautifully drawn. Beautifully drawn.
You know that More Fun Comics 73. I mean, not only is it the first appearance of Green Arrow and Speedy and Aquaman, it's also got the Spectre in the, I mean, not first appearances, but also
No.
appearing in the issue is Spectre, Dr. Fate, Johnny Quick. That's a hell of a comic right
More
there,
Fun
man.
Comics was a good book. They had a lot of good
Man,
strips in it. They really,
that is
really
good
did.
stuff. All right, so here's Speedy's origin, which is tied to the origin of Green Arrow. So here we go. So this plane crashes far from civilization into a place called the Lost Mesa. And the only survivors in the plane crash are little Roy Harper and their servant, who's a Native American. He's a family servant. And to survive, Roy is taught archery. So years later, the gazillionaire Oliver Queen, who is not Green Arrow at this point, he hears about this Lost Mesa and decides to go on an expedition to explore because he's that kind of guy. So Queen, though, is followed by criminals to the Lost Mesa who think that it's full of treasure. So Oliver Queen and Roy Harper meet there in the Lost Mesa. They team up because they're both master archers. They defeat the criminals. As a result, Oliver Queen decides to become the Green Arrow, and Roy Harper, his ward, becomes Speedy. So there's your origin of the Golden Age Green Arrow.
Aha.
So what leaves me wondering, though, if the Lost Mesa is so hard to find and is so far from civilization, how did these criminals follow Oliver Queen unless they were already independently wealthy, which defeats the purpose of going? So I don't get that. But as you mentioned, they both served in the Seven Soldiers of Victory, but also served in the All-Star Squadron. And then there's this famous story in the JLA about how the Seven Soldiers of Victory got lost in time. Poor Roy Harper gets sent back to ancient Greece and turned into a centaur by Circe. Man, Roy cannot catch a break on any alternate Earth. I'm just saying. And in the Serprint, I didn't need to see a picture of him as a centaur, but I guess it was important to them. Eventually, Roy's returned to the 20th century, but decades after his own time, which left me wondering, like, he really would have been perfect in the Super Squad, along with
Star-Spangled
Star-Spangled
Kid
Kid
and
and
Power
Power
Girl.
Girl and all that. Yeah. Now, you would have had two time-lost characters because that was sort of Star-Spangled Kid's shtick that he was a man out of time and Speedy was too. But I think it really would have worked. And that's a shame because I would have loved to see more adventures with Speedy from Earth 2.
I can see that. Yeah. A
Yep.
lot of Green Arrow this episode.
Yep, there sure is. Now, similar to Green Arrow, you can find Speedy in a bunch of places. The Arrow TV show, Young Justice, Batman Brave and the Bold, Justice League Unlimited, Teen Titans, Then in the 1990s, he became a character called Arsenal, and then later he became a character called Red Arrow. But since the 2000s, he's had a bit of a rough go of it. At one point, he lost his arm and got a cybernetic arm. His daughter was murdered. I mean,
Oh,
just some terrible,
jeez.
yeah, exactly. Terrible crap happened to him. But thankfully, I'm pretty sure with all 16 of DC's reboots over the last couple of years, that's all been undone now. You could also find him as like in the Titans or eventually the Outsiders or Red Hood and the Outlaws. He's had a pretty big career. He's out there in a lot of places. So good to see for Speedy. Good to go.
Did he ever get hooked on heroin, though?
The Earth 2 Speedy? No. And all
Okay.
these things, I mean, all the stuff I was just mentioning really is the Earth 1 Speedy anyway. I mean, really, we've never seen the Earth 2 Speedy after that Justice League Secret, Seven Soldiers of Victory story. Technically, I don't think we've ever seen the second Earth 2 Speedy again. But,
Okay.
I kind of conflate them together. If you're talking about where to find more of the character.
Okay.
All right, we're going to hit the randomizer, and boy, it's random. Boop, boop,
Beep,
boop,
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 beep,
boop,
boop,
boop.
boop, boop, beep. Oh, we did it in stereo. Yeah, a Stalker, drawn by
Woof.
Steve Ditko and Joe Orlando. Everyone remembers Stalker the series, right? From the 70s. It was a huge hit. It ran 4 issues. And then at least in the Silver Age, Bronze Age comic DC Comic Universe, Stalker was never seen again. Now maybe again, maybe he's come back, but in time of this publication, he got 4 issues and that was it. Now, you know, I know I said earlier in a previous episode, if you ever got your own series, you should get a Who's Who listing, right? Because I said that about Rima the Jungle Girl. I am
Walking it back,
looking
walking
at
it
this kind
back.
of going, well, all right, does he really need his own thing? Maybe so. I like his look. I like he's got the orange eyes. He doesn't have like pupils and stuff. There is a crap ton of detail in the surprint as drawn by Steve Ditko. There is multiple panel insets of Stalker, whose alter ego is unknown, doing a bunch of things, and he's got a little dagger and he's got a knife. He's fighting this demon. The logo is right from the comic book. I never read this book. I only know the covers by Ditko and Wally Wood, which are really beautiful. I did read the listing here, but I was like, I just kind of grayed out, kind of like, all right, I don't, whatever.
Right.
I don't really care. But nevertheless, Joe Orlando makes a nice sinker for Steve Ditko.
He does. He does. So the character is created by Paul Levitz and Steve Ditko together. And I mean, the costume, it looks, it's a D&D character, is what this boils down to. As you read the entry, it sounds like a really bitchin' D&D campaign, right? It sounds super cool if you're into that kind of thing, right? Which is not where I am. But the costume, it looks great. It looks like something out of D&D. It's great complementary colors of green and orange. You've got daggers and swords and pouches and belts and all, scarabs and all this cool stuff. So I mean, it looks like a very well-designed fantasy character. And it's, come on, it's Steve Ditko. I mean, you can't knock that, which is great. And as you mentioned, he appeared in those four issues. So Stalker number one came out in 1975. And unfortunately, I cannot think of this character without conflating him with Claw the Unconquered. Like, I always think of them together. And I had to look it up. Not only do they both have that fantasy vibe, but actually they both hit in the summer of 1975, only like a month or two apart, and both have very similar trade dress. And I think they both lasted about as long. So yeah, that I always associate the two characters together, even though they obviously have no connection other than the time they were published. Apparently, there is a version, very changed, but there is a version of this character who appeared in Batman Beyond, shockingly.
Batman Beyond.
Now, it may have been the Batman Beyond comic, I don't know, but apparently Batman
That's
Beyond.
no less bizarre, but okay, sure. All right.
A very, very different version, but it's attributed to this one. So,
Okay.
all right. Boop, 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 boop. To go from fantasy to Western, up next is the Trigger Twins from Who's Who, issue 24, art by Carmen Infantino and Dick Giordano. I love this. So what you've got in the artwork here is you've got two guys who, it's interesting, they look identical, and yet Carmen has taken the time to draw each one of them differently. So it's not just a stat from one to the other, which he totally could have done, but it's two guys who are essentially identical, both dressed as old Western sheriffs, wearing, sort of the khaki beige sort of outfits with a black neckerchief kind of thing, with red hair and their sheriff star and a six shooter on the side, and they're both hands on hips, akimbo, of course. And then in the surprint in green, you've got lots of shots of the Trigger Twins, confronting villains, helping each other, like one's, sneaking around while the other one's confronting the bad guy, things like that. So lots of opportunities, and I'll explain why that makes sense in just a second. But what do you think of the art?
I like it. As you say, if you look closely, they are two different drawings. They are very similar, but they are two different ones. He didn't just take it and stat it, which would have been okay too,
Right.
if you wanted to just be clever and do that. But yeah, I love their logo, right? They have a great logo.
No, it's nice. Yeah.
And they first appeared in All-Star Western number 58, which, if memory serves, is the first issue of All-Star Comics after they got rid of the JSA and
Well done.
changed the book into a Western title. So, they had a lot to live up to, right? If you're a comic kid, right, and you're reading Justice Society, and then the next issue you're like, what the hell is this? This is not what I asked for. But now it's good.
Little
It's
Roy
cool.
Thomas got this issue in the mail and
There
said,
you go.
WTF, because suddenly his characters were gone. Now, I just want to mention about All-Star Western 58. Not only you nailed it, good job. That was going to be one of my questions for you. But other characters that premiered in that same issue, the Roving Ranger, who we talked about last time, Trigger Twins, Don Caballero, who I'm pretty sure has a Who's Who entry, and Strongbow. I don't know if Strongbow has a Who's Who entry, but I've definitely heard of that character. So a lot of Western characters all premiered in that issue.
All right, good one. Good on them.
So I interrupted you. I apologize because I wanted to get that out, tie
No,
in there.
I'm just now. I am glad that DC's. I mean, I know that all the Western characters got roped into the DCU proper, but I'm glad that so many of the Western characters got listings, right? Because most kids reading comics, Who's Who in 1985, were like, the Trigger Twins. What do I care about them? But no, And I like that they each get their own separate listing, right? It's Walter Trigger and Wayne Trigger, and then their combined history and their combined powers and weapons. But I dig it.
I do think the personal data is a tad redundant because, like, other than their name and their jobs, everything's identical. So I do feel like that could have been combined a little
They're
bit.
both the exact same weight. They really
Right.
work hard to make sure that.
Exactly. Say everything is eye color, every bit of it is the same, But anyway, so the deal here is that Walt Trigger is the sheriff in Rocky City, and Wayne Trigger, his identical twin brother, is a storekeeper there. And basically, there is too much trouble in town for Sheriff Walt to handle by himself. So his twin brother would dress up just like the sheriff, and they would help to solve crimes. Essentially, what they did this so they could be in two places at once. They even had identical horses. So basically, the whole gimmick would be like one person would confront, which is what we're seeing the serpent. One of them would confront the bad guy, while the other one's like sneaking up from behind to bushwhack him or whatever, whatever needed to get done to help stop the bad guys. So that was great. And it was a gimmick that they kept going all along. Like nobody in the town found out that there were two sheriffs running around, basically. They were able to somehow keep it a secret from the whole town that they were doing this. So it's a fun gimmick. I love the idea. It's like whatever that show was with the twins, where the twins would fool their parents all the time, and I'm forgetting the name of it. Famous show. Anyway, really helps the story. Thanks for jumping in and helping
I
me.
don't know the name of it. I don't know the show
It's a
you're referring to.
famous show with twins. Anyway, so here is where my in-stock trades pick came in. So do you remember my in-stock trades pick earlier?
Yeah, the Nightwing.
Exactly, Nightwing. So in 1993, they introduced in the Batman books a pair of twins who look just like this, and they're introduced as Batman bad guys. They're not supposed to be the same guys. They're a different set of twins going around calling themselves the Trigger Twins. And they were in a handful of Batman comics, but mostly they appeared in Nightwing comics. And they were kind of like henchmen. They weren't like the main bad guy. They would just always be like henchmen, and they were the Trigger Twins. They looked just like this, and they go around, and Scott McDaniel would draw them, and Nightwing would beat them up. And they worked for Blockbuster, and I loved it. So they were in the Nightwing book. Now they weren't in the issues that's in the Nightwing collection, which makes it even more tangentially related. But I don't care. I had to mention it. So there we go.
That is very random.
Well, but they look really cool in the Nightwing. They totally work as Batman universe bad guys, like just a stupid, henchmen. It really works.
As a side thing, when you said they work for Blockbuster, I pictured them rewinding tapes and stuff like
Oh
that. I know you
gosh.
realize you meant the other Blockbuster, but that's sort of where my brain went.
They're always screaming, "Welcome to Blockbuster!" Also, apparently, there was an episode in the Arrowverse, because it keeps coming up, where there's an episode, a crossover, where Barry Allen and Oliver Queen end up in a parallel universe and they pose as the Trigger Twins. I
Oh
don't
my
know.
God.
I don't know if they
Wow.
pose as these guys, but there's something in the Wikipedia basically that says they pose as the Trigger Twins. I don't know what the heck that's about, but it cracked my junk up.
Unbelievable.
So, all right, Rob. Well, that is our 13 entries. Now we do have a Zoom Yukinori inspired drawing here. So this is Zoom and Isamu Yukinori's addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. So this entry we're doing today is the terrific What's It, drawn by Namiko Hideaki Yukinori. So super exciting. So I'm gonna I don't know. We didn't say who was leading on this one, but I just assumed I would take the lead. I don't know if you
Sure,
got
go right ahead.
okay. So I will just kind of basically describe it, then I'm going to tell you something, and then I'll go back to detail. So it is essentially an anthropomorphic turtle who's running around in Jay Garrick's Flash costume. Okay,
Yes.
so put that in your head: anthropomorphic turtle running around in Jay Garrick's Flash costume in the style of old 1940s Funnies comics, which is super great with awesome surprint. I'm going to talk more about it in a minute, but what I want to read from you is an excerpt from an interview that appeared in 13th Dimension. And it was with Namiko about this entry. And the interviewee was none other than Chris Franklin from our own network. So Chris asked, he says, "As a huge fan of the Jay Garrick Flash and the Zoo Crew, I was very happy to see the terrific What's It get his own due. Was this a fun piece for you to create, Namiko?" So Namiko answers, "I am glad to hear it. And yes, it was fun. And I had a lot of good source material to work with. In fact, I found myself swiping funny stuff," which, by the way, that's the name of the comic that it came from. "So I found myself swiping Funny Stuff comic panels for some of the Serpent illustrations because I couldn't top what the artist had already done. So I tried to ape the artist style when I drew the main figure and the rest of the artwork." So there we go, from Namiko herself. So the character here is, his real name is Merton McSnurtle the Turtle, which is like the greatest name ever. I mean, they should have just stopped making comics at that point, honestly, in 1944. They should have just put up their hands and said, we are never going to beat Merton McSnurtle the Turtle. Quite frankly, it's the best. So in the yard here, as I said, he's wearing a Jay Garrick costume. He's running. He looks like a turtle. In the surprint, you've got these sort of creatures floating above him, which are like these evil princes that are related to him getting his powers. You've got him foiling some bad guys and knocking him out. Then you've got him in his Merton McSnurtle secret identity, where he's incredibly lazy. He's sleeping and sawing a log. And then in the top right-hand corner, you've got him out of his shell and his robot. Oh, I promise I'll explain. His robotic conscience is urging him into action to go be a hero. And it's a great logo, too. So, what do you think about all this, buddy?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's beautiful, right? I mean, not only is it beautifully penciled, but the ink line that D'Amico brings to this is really gorgeous. Like,
Oh,
it's a
yeah.
very, very tight and precise and perfect amalgamation of the funny animal style. I love the way it's colored. It's only because we can't pick these entries as one of our favorites, and this would not be on my list of favorites for the
Oh,
issue,
yeah.
right? It's so wonderfully done, and as we mentioned, I think in the last episode of Who's Who, I wish that the funny animal characters had been given like a group 2-page spread of just some of them, because this belongs on here. I mean, it's a parody of the Flash, for Pete's sakes. You know, they gave every Captain Carrot character a listing. You can't do terrific. What's it? And he headlined it Funny Stuff Number One. Funny Stuff ran for decade, not decades, but many, many years as a series. It got reprints in DC Digest, which we even covered on Digest Cast. This is a beautiful entry. It's gorgeous.
She did an amazing
She did.
job. It is just gorgeous and love it. And you guys, by the way, remember, you can go out to our gallery and see this too. So here's some of the history on Merton McSnurtle the Turtle, the peak of character naming in comic book history. And I mean that. I'm not being sarcastic. I just want to make that clear. So anyway, the known relative is Fastback from Captain Carrot and the Amazing Zoo Crew. So
Of
there's your
course.
connection to Captain Carrot. Weight is 20 pounds, but 48 pounds with the shell. Because, and the shell is literally weighing on his conscience, which is what it says here. I mean, the whole thing, and I don't know whether Nemico wrote the entry as well, or maybe this is what Zoom had written previously. I don't know that off the top of my head, so I apologize. I'm sure Isamu will let us know. But it is hilarious. I mean, it is genuinely funny to read. So take time to read this on the website. It's a lot of fun. So he is from the universe of Earthsea, which is full of anthropomorphic animals, as we know. And Merton McSnurtle got scooped up to another planet and caught up in this sort of cosmic game of good and evil. These two space princes, they wager that they could give a completely honest person superpowers, and that honest person would eventually be corrupted by power and use it for evil. Basically, it's the plot of the movie Trading Places. So Merton McSnurtle is this really honest soul, but he's also incredibly lazy. So unfortunately, the trip to space cracked his turtle shell. So a turtle without his shell on looks really weird, which is where he gets the name What's It from, because he looks like a weird, doesn't look like a turtle. And Merton is given the powers of super speed, amazing strength, and he's made bulletproof. And he's returned to Earthsea, but the one change is that McSnurtle's, I love saying this, his turtle shell has been repaired, but it now has the addition of a little mechanical turtle that comes out and operates as McSnurtle's conscience, constantly goading him into doing good deeds, sort of like a Jiminy Cricket kind of thing. Now, it does not mention this in the bio, but as I said, the terrific What's Its costume looks just like Jay Garrick's The Flash costume, but on a turtle. I don't know if there's an in-story reason for that or not, because I've never read these. But the first appearance is Funny Stuff in 1944, and that is just 4 years after the debut of Jay Garrick. And it got me thinking, Rob, like, I think this is the earliest appearance of a parody anthropomorphic animal based on a superhero. I think. I don't know.
I mean, there might be somebody, but yeah, that is pretty early, right? That's just how popular Flash was, that they could do a parody version and it would, like it would work for any length of time. By the way, Funny Stuff ran 79 issues.
Jeez.
And then it became Dodo and the Frog. They took over the book. But McSnurtle the Turtle did not run through the entire series. Do you want to guess? You like to do this to
me. Oh, I love this.
Do you know
this.
How many issues of funny stuff McSnurtle had a storyline in?
He premiered in 1944, so I'm going to say 44 issues.
17.
Oh, 17. Really?
So not as long as some of the other characters, but hey, that's four times as long as Stalker. So there you go.
Wow. So Rob, let me ask you: do you think that the terrific What's It has managed to break out of comic books into other media?
The answer to that is clearly going to be yes. Is Guillermo del Toro working on a movie on this one as well, or what?
Damn close. I mean, it's huge, Rob.
Chris Nolan? What are we talking about?
He's already been in a movie. He has been in the DC League of Super Pets movie
from a couple years ago. Why, of course he was, yes.
There's a super fast turtle in there named Merton. It's a female turtle, though, and voiced by Natasha Lyonne. So
that's like, just a random series of words.
Well, you know who Natasha Lyonne is, though.
Yeah, right? I know. I'm just saying, like, Natasha Lyonne, like, what, her? Okay, sure. So, yeah, why not?
Now, they didn't call him, McSturtle. He was called Merton, which is the first name. He wasn't called the terrific What's It, but he was the super fast turtle named Merton. So, I mean, that's it right there.
Right? My name is Merton.
And there are a couple references on the Flash TV show. Like, at one point, somebody has a pet turtle named McSnurtle. Or there's a stuffed turtle that someone, you know, in the shot they called McSnurtle. So it's out there in the world, which is just insane. So Nemiko, I'm sorry, I don't know the correct pronunciation, but thank you so much for this entry. I absolutely love it. It is so full of joy.
Beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff.
All right, Rob. So now, with the exception of Merton and McSnurtle, who out of the 13 entries, the original ones we covered, who are your favorite entries for this issue?
I always just go with three, right? Or do three or four?
We usually do three, but I've got an honorable mention at the end.
Okay. This one's kind of easy. Dead Man, Green Arrow, and Onyx. Those are the three.
Okay. We overlap on two. Dead Man and Onyx, for sure. I also pick Speedy over two. So I pick Speedy over two over the Green Arrow entry. I just think it's artistically more impressive. But then my honorable mention is one that you poo-pooed all over, which is Bizarro World. I love that entry.
I don't think I was that bad about it. I just was kind of mixed. Like, all right.
Roll back the tape. So, all right. Well, folks, that's going to do that. We're done with those entries. So we are going to take a podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to cover your feedback in a segment called Who's Who, Hows and Whys.
In 1987, a legend was reborn when George Perez and DC Comics recreated and relaunched Wonder Woman, helping bring some truth and understanding to the newly formed post-crisis DC universe. Between the bullets, the bracelets, angry gods, a new city, and a new supporting cast, Wonder Woman rejoined the never-ending battle for a more loving and peaceful way of life. Join me, Sean, and a bevy of all-star podcast guests on Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, where we review each issue of the George Perez written and drawn Wonder Woman series and try to bring some peace to man's world each month. So find a little bit of paradise only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. What's so funny about this love and understanding? Oh,
what's so funny about this love and understanding? Worlds would live.
Worlds would die.
And DC Comics would never be the same again.
Crisis on Infinite Earths, the crossover so epic it reached every corner of the DC multiverse. Join DC Dave
and Doug Adamson as we discuss The Monitor Tapes,
a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast.
Find us on your favorite podcatcher and join the discussion at themonitortapes.com.
All right, we're back for Who's Who, Hows, and Whys. And just as a reminder, folks, if you don't mind, please leave us an iTunes review. If you haven't left one yet, please consider it. It does really help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. And you can look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, which is a little long to type in. So if you just type Who's Who review, you'll find it that way as well. So we would appreciate it, and we'll read your whole review on the air. Now, let's get into your feedback that was left on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. You go out there, find the Who's Who page, and look for this episode, Who's Who Review number 11, and you can leave your feedback there. We'll read it next time. But this is feedback from Who's Who Review number 10. When you start us off, Rob.
All right. First up is Brian Schufo, who says that Supermobile entry was fantastic. Yes, it was. There are tears of joy, laughter, and nostalgia running down my face. I probably only had one issue featuring the Supermobile, but it made a huge impression. In sixth grade, my friends and I would design futuristic spaceships, and no one could understand why mine had arms. Philistines! The no engine detail was new to me, but that makes perfect sense. In the Silver Age, it is hilarious. Thanks to everyone who had a hand in putting together that entry. Absolutely, Brian. It is one of my all of Zoom Zoo are fantastic, but that is one of my favorites.
I went back and I listened to the last episode just to refamiliarize with what we were talking about, because I forget these things the minute we're done talking about it. And the Supermobile discussion is genuinely hilarious. I mean, we're just dying laughing over things like that there's no engine in there.
I did not know that. That is just such a great, insane Superman detail.
And your obsession with the Supermobile, by the way, folks, pretty much if anyone left a comment that mentioned the Supermobile, I'm pretty sure Rob highlighted it to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
So, or, as you mentioned, Brian Schufo mentioned that he would draw his spaceships with arms. So Dick followed that comment up and said, the Outlaw Star anime proved conclusively that spaceships are 1,000% cooler when they have arms. How else are they supposed to carry giant pistols and katanas? They were from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories, who says, before I even listen to you guys, I want you to know that I saw this drop when I had been working on my latest story for 18 hours. But you guys are good enough, so I wanted to listen while I could keep my eyes open. Aw. Well, I'm flattered, Rob. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Then we're from Hal, who says there are at least two other characters who debuted in novels besides Dr. Mist. See, this is where you made your mistake, Rob.
I don't make declarative statements anymore.
Exactly. You were really good about it this episode. Hal says one was Rima, who first appeared in a book called Green Mansions.
Green Mansions, right.
The other one, as you thought, which is what I guessed, was Richard Dragon. He appeared in a book called Kung Fu Master Richard Dragon, Dragon's Fist, and it was written by Denny O'Neill under a pseudonym. Now, here's where I actually get to call Hal out, because he says that Rima appeared in a book as well. But I got to correct you, Hal. Rima didn't appear in Who's Who. It was only that Zoom's Who entry that we love so much.
Right.
So it looks like it is just Dr. Mist and Richard Dragon. So Hal goes on to say, I, Vampire, ended with a missed opportunity. Bennett's then love interest, Deborah Dancer, had ingested a potential cure for vampirism before Bloody Mary killed her and destroyed Bennett. She arose as a vampire, but she still had her own willpower and was able to survive in the daylight. She basically became a version of Marvel's Blade. Such potential, but they never used her again pre-crisis. Well, that's disappointing. We could have had a Blade-Deborah Dancer team-up crossover. Would have been great. Now, one interesting fact that I noted, this is still Hal, that all of DC's then current supernatural heroes had girlfriends with alliterative names. Abby Arcane, Betty Berg, Cassandra Kraft, and Deborah Dancer. Good to know the Lois Lane lineage continues on.
And that list is AABBCCDD as well.
Oh, you're right. I didn't even pick up on that. Ooh, that's interesting. I don't even know Betty Berg and Cassandra Kraft. I don't know.
I know Cassandra Kraft. I didn't know Betty Berg. Kevin from New Orleans says, a few things. I recently got a trade of the Eye Vampire stories from House of Mystery, and they were really cool. Plus, the updated version of him is pretty awesome. It was one of the few new 52 books I picked up. In the Plasma Century, it says the General Zal has an entry, but he doesn't, and he should. He caused the original Doom Patrol to die. Shag, you are correct. One of the soldiers in the Aquaman movie looked just like the Scavenger. I figured it was a nod to him.
Ah, good, because I was pretty sure that someone had those like sharp teeth, you know, bathysphere helmet kind of thing that Scavenger had. So good. Thank you, Kevin, for letting me know.
I'm sure I thought that when I watched the movie, but as I said, that movie slid out of my brain by the time I was in the lobby, so I don't remember anything from it.
They heard from someone, and I don't know whether they go by MeZ or Mez or Me.Z. I'm not sure, but one of those.
Me.Z, I'd say.
Me.Z, okay. Writes, wow, two Flash rogues in one show. That's two more than the movie, unfortunately. Ouch. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Me.Z. Then says, Captain Boomerang is great because he's a simple guy who can do something simple in an extraordinary way. I think that was sort of interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. It is something simple, and yet he does do it in an extraordinarily good way. That's a good point. And as for the weather wizard, he was kind of a bore until Geoff Johns took him over, where he established that he was well-read and often quoted Shakespeare. Wow. I don't even remember that, but I guess that was from the Johns run. Interesting. The Johns flash run, by the way, really is very, very good. Back when he was writing Wally, it was a very, very good book.
All right. Edo Boznar, regarding Clue Master, he says, I'll admit that the one and only place I ever saw him, he was in the excellent Batman 336 with art by JLGL PBHN, which I purchased in a Whitman 3-pack. That's a winner if you got that in a Whitman 3-pack. I've probably mentioned it in the comments, too, for All Mankind, but I kind of like the Global Guardians. Besides, as you highlighted, I also kind of like Bushmaster, and those two ladies will always be in Green Fury and Ice Maiden to me. P.S. Rob, I agree. Hooper is indeed a good movie. I agree. And I should mention, since then, I have for some reason purchased, well, my wife purchased it for me because I asked her to, because she saw it in the store, Hooper on video disc, the long dead format. But she was in a store and she knows I like collecting dead formats. And she showed me a picture of what they had available. And I was like, ooh, get me Hooper. So now I have Hooper on a giant format that I cannot watch.
You are insane, man. I mean, if you're going to have the four, you should at least get a player. Like, I watched a movie on VHS last night, by the way. So, like, why? Dead formats, they're a long story. VHS, dead formats can live on. So get a video disc player, especially
since not all porn has been transferred to Blu-ray, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. And especially since you you begrudge the good name of Smokey and the Bandit, saying Hooper's better. So
Hooper's a really good movie. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, but you offended me. You offended me and Chris Franklin by saying it was better than Smoking the Bandit. Anyway.
Okay. All right.
Then we're from Isamu Hideaki Yukinori, of Zooms Who, obviously, says Cluemaster's logo is from the lettering of the title of his first appearance story in the Cluemaster's Topsy-Turvy Crimes in Detective Comics 351. That's amazing that they went to the lengths of pulling that that logo. That's awesome, Isamu. Thanks for sharing that. And then Carmen Infantino penciled the story, which explained why he penciled the entry. There you go, because I was confused last time because all these years seeing Carmine draw Cluemaster made me think he was a Flash rogue for a long time.
I love the idea that they have stats of like every issue of every comic that they need, and they send somebody – you know, into the wherever they, because this is pre-digital. So like all of those just existed as stats somewhere, and they send somebody down to the vault, right, to go pull up Detective Comics 351 and stat the Cluemaster logo, put it as extra work, right? That's good. Good for you.
I'm just assuming it was Todd Klein every single time. It's probably not right, but
Anyway, he continues on. Dr. Light 2. I had already explained last time that the decision to make the new Dr. Light Japanese, but I didn't mention that the original plan of replacing Light with a female character was way back in 1982. From an October 1982 interview with Marv Wolfman, when issue number 27 of the first New Teen Titans series was on the newsstands, published in the Comics Journal number 80. I'm thinking of killing Dr. Light and having someone female wear his costume. Since all his powers are in his costume, anyone could wear it. Unstable molecules, it's skin tight. Man, again, nice pull, Isamu. That's impressive. Wow.
That's interesting. Okay. Then he mentions Weather Wizard. We joked about how Weather Wizard was like the TV pilot guy, because he was in the pilot for the Justice League TV series that failed. He was in the first pilot for the pilot for the Flash TV series in the 2000s. He says Weather Wizard has been a TV star since 1978.
Right. Yep.
He was one of the villains in the Legends of the Superheroes live action specials produced by Hanna-Barbera. He was played by comedian Jeff Altman, whose other claim to fame was a co-starring role in the Croft variety show Pink Lady. So that's another example. I mean, you could argue that Legends of the Superheroes kind of may have been a pilot. Like, if it had taken off, maybe we'd have got more of a live action stuff. You could argue that's a pilot as well. So I think Weather Wizard is the TV pilot guy.
Yeah. I mean, anything's a TV pilot if it becomes popular, really.
Right.
You know,
right.
Anything they put on television, if it gets a huge rating, they make more of them. So,
yep.
And he continues on. Supermobile. Was Lord. One.
Here we go. Here we go.
I did a control F and then just highlighted every time I found Supermobile. Supermobile was one of the two volume two entries that Dad fully completed himself. Sugar and Spike was the other. He found the Supermobile to be a goofy idea that didn't completely make sense in the original story in Action Comics. For example, if Superman was able to retain his superpowers in the vehicle, then why does he need the supervision scope on the dashboard? At least on the Super Friends cartoon, they explain that it is a vehicle designed to mimic Superman Superman superpowers whenever Superman himself is under a red sun or lost most of his powers to old age. That was a neat superpowers collection commercial stinger. Did you know that the Supermobile appeared on Batman the Brave and the Bold cartoon as the Lexor 7? Not that it was named that, but in the Battle of the Superheroes, it was Luthor's attack vehicle that had the same design as the Supermobile, complete with robot arms, and was painted in Luthor's green and purple color scheme. I mean, I'm sure I saw that episode because I saw every episode of that show. I have no memory of that, but again, great, great pull, Isamu.
That's awesome. And I'm so glad he explained that it was in the Super Friends cartoon that they had the Supermobile help Superman. Because, like, it was really bothering me last episode. Like, the fact that the ship did not have any, you know, propulsion. And I'm like, wait a minute. My memory was that Superman specifically used this thing when he didn't have power. So that's where my memory must come from with Super Friends. Okay. All right. Then we're from Movie Matt Sorois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast. He says, guys, this was a wonderful birthday present. Maybe the best since I got the Kenner Death Star playset.
Wow.
We rate pretty high, buddy.
That's a very big compliment.
Yep. And he says, Clue Master went out like a hero, saving his buddy Major Disaster in the first issue of Keith Giffen's Suicide Squad. Of course, that was prior to the New 52, Rebirth, All In, and all that, so I don't know where he stands. By the way, I just got to endorse that Keith Giffen Suicide Squad series. It was only 12 issues. It is so freaking good. I love, love, love that comic. In fact, I think they're covering it over on that Giffen show right now. But such a great comic. Love it. Then he says, it's a shame that the second Dr. Light's career was derailed for whatever reason. Pulling her from the Justice League ruined her chances to become a bigger presence in the DCU. Yeah, I think, you know, Giffen and DeMatteis, for whatever reason, pulled her. But I think they really could have done some fun stuff with her. With her, you know, sort of harsh attitude and things like that. She really would have been an interesting contrast on the team. But it's a shame. Then we'll hear from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, I'd have to say, besides Rita, I'm most familiar of the Flash Rogues, Captain Boomerang, and Weather Wizard, or as he's called in the Batman manga, Go-Go the Magician. What the what? So, Bucky, you blew my mind and sent me down a rabbit hole looking up Go-Go the Magician. I even share with Rob here a page from it, which is just insane that he's called Go-Go the Magician. I don't think I've ever loved a better renaming of a character than that. It's so ridiculous. All right.
Really nice artwork in the piece you put in the notes. It's really, yeah. Really nice.
Yeah. That's the Batman manga that we're looking at, by mm-hmm. the way, folks. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Chris Mort says, another stellar show. Who doesn't love Captain Boomerang's costume? Part magician, part pajamas, all fun. I always wondered why they didn't do more after introducing the heroic Dr. Light. If I ever get to ask Marv Wolfman anything, that would be it. Rob's fan casting of Sydney Sweeney as Power Girl is brilliant. I never thought about that, but now I can't unsee it. If it happens, I hope they go with the boob window. You could make a case for one of the other prints in Animal Man's logo being a giraffe. Finally, if I encounter a 100-foot woman in a miniskirt, I'm looking up, just saying. Keep up the great work, and remember, Mort's rock. I think I showed great restraint in this episode, by the way.
You really did. I'm sure Chris really appreciated it. And by the way, Rob and I stumbled across someone had done some fan art of Sydney Sweeney as Power Girl, and damn, it works. She really would have been perfect as Power Girl. So.
It's right there. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It's right there. Matt Ev, he's the network's resident yoga master. he says, much as I'd love to offer a 12-page thesis on Animal Man, and that title's importance in my life as a locus of experimental storytelling, animal rights, and indefensibly dorky costumes, I'll save that for my long gestation index show, Hey Buddy, coming to a podcatcher near you, you've never heard of. CF aforementioned Brain Chaos. That's a great title, right?
If you're right. Hey, buddy, for an Animal Man. It's brilliant. Yeah. Oh, man, I wish you
would. One thing I will mention is that the Supermobile, hey, there it is again, instinctively gives me the feelings of sadness and disappointment, even when lovingly rendered by Zoom. I had the Corgi toy as a kid, and I was perpetually frustrated by the fact that fists do not extend beyond the nose cone, rendering them all but useless. As an adult, I realize that this is an irrational response and that I should just embrace the dorkiness of the plane with fists concept. So the revelation that Superman is flying this contraption under his own power in a seated position considerably ups the dorkiness factor and significantly contributes to healing my childhood trauma. So thanks for that. Glad to help, Matt.
I adore him.
Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog comic box commentary, plus the Legion of Super Bloggers, currently trying to worm his way into the Supergirl movie premiere next summer online. Get on that, James Gunn. He talks about a couple different characters. First of all, Elastigirl. Yes, Byrne loves the Doom Patrol. Yes, his run on Doom Patrol stinks. But I'll remind everyone that he not only did the Who's Who entry, but he also did the Secret Origins annual covering the team. That book is awesome.
Fantastic. He also talks about Nemesis Kid. He said, because I had given a shout out for Nemesis Kid last time. He says, yes, I love this character. There's a bunch of things to love. First off, great power set. Second, his heel turn in that first story is a huge piece of Legion lore. The whole time he's setting up the Karate Kid to look like a traitor, setting up his grudge between them forever. And when they square off, Nemesis's Kid's powers kick in. You might think they would go for like invulnerable to counteract Karate Kid's powers. No. He just manifests better karate, which is insanity, and he beats him to a pulp. But then when he meets up to fight Princess Projecta, his powers kick in, making him see through her illusions. But that didn't help him when she used her combat training to snap his neck. The whole thing is fantastic. Everyone should love this character and story. Wow. Man. And now, I mean, Dr. Ange, really, it was an embarrassment of riches for this episode. Not only do we talk about Mark Shaw and your damn Leviathan thing, you also got Hyathis mentions. I mean, he's got to be floating on cloud nine right now.
I'm sure he has so little in his life that these mentions on Who's Who is really the highlight of his existence.
Probably.
So, Chris Franklin, of course, from this very network, hosts the ALU cast, Batman Nightcast, and many, many more. He says, I'm confused. Who am I supposed to hold down and or punch? I'll just sick Cindy on you. You both know she hits hard. When I read that, I pictured Cindy knocking our heads together like Mo did with Larry and Curly. It was that kind of thing. So
I have been punched by Cindy. So let me tell you, it is not a fun feeling, folks. It still hurts. And it's been like 7 years.
I have not been, which I'm proud of, because that means I've been, you know, I've been keeping things above board. Kyle Baker on Kurt Swan is a nice combo. And usually I hate those type of avant-garde artists over the old masters. I'm looking at a Paro Bill Sienkiewicz spell. Sienkiewicz, of course. Blech. But Swan was far more illustrative than almost any inker ever captured. Just look at how Al Williamson inked him in the later days of a Superman run. Beautiful stuff. Oh, and don't you dare stop the randomizer noises. I think Rob may be the next Michael Winslow from the Police Academy film. I know that's meant to be a compliment, but it's also an insult at the same time. So well done, Chris.
Michael Winslow, you got to be kidding. He was fantastic. My wife met him one time.
All right, that's a whole other story. But all right.
Oh, is he like not a good person?
No, I'm just saying, like, does he have a career that is really worth emulating at this point? That's all. I don't know. Maybe he's massively successful or something. I don't know. But
he did like 47 of those movies. So. They were from Super Captain. It says, I love this show. Animal Man, I first met him in one of the Forgotten Heroes in DC Comics Presents, but his solo series hit right as I stopped getting comics for a bit, so the new 52 Jeff Lemire run is the standard for me. It had a great combination of really weird stuff and family relationships to which Shag alluded. Well, I'm glad you like that, Super Captain. Yeah, the new 52 series was super fun, and if you enjoyed that, I would recommend you try the Grant Morrison era, too. It's very available nowadays, and it's really good stuff. Then he says, my favorite entry is definitely the Global Guardians. I love that concept so much, and several of the characters have a great potential, in my opinion. Their debuts in the Super Friends books were some of the first comics I remember reading. Back in June, I picked up the new copy of their appearance at DC Comics Presents number 46, and since I'm a big Infinity Inc. fan, I quite like their encounters with the Infinitors. I didn't know about Justice League Europe, so I'll be on the lookout for those issues too. I find a lot of joy in weird offbeat teams such as Infinity Inc., Global Guardians, Great Ten, Freedom Fighters, and others. I guess what Yukon Cornelius and Rudolph and Hermie could be said of me, even among misfits, I'm a misfit. Well, Super Captain, those Justice League Europe issues are very interesting. I mean, the Global Guardians are the bad guys in the story because they're being controlled by the Queen Bee, but they do get a lot of screen time, so I think you might enjoy it.
Nate the Great says, you know, it could never happen now, but for a while I really wanted Kaley Cuoco to play Power Girl. I could see that.
Oh, okay.
But Rob's right. Sweeney would work now. Of course, Byrne's version of Elastigirl really looks like 90s Tiffany Amber Thiessen when she was really hot.
Oh, wow.
Captain Boomerang didn't really become a star until he fought Batman and joined the Suicide Squad. Something about the Barry Allen pre-crisis Flash that just didn't quite cause that. Same for the Weather Wizard. I'm surprised Rob didn't mention Adventure Comics number 450, a Jim Aparo issue where he fought Aquaman and didn't come off like a total dork. Yeah, I should have mentioned that because that actually, that adventure run is my favorite run of Aquaman comics of all time, period. So I should have mentioned that.
Oh, wow.
Good book, yeah.
So who did he fight? Did he fight? Because he mentioned a couple different characters.
Weather Wizard. He fought Weather Wizard.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. Captain Entropy writes in to say, I laughed out loud multiple times through the show, and I needed it today. Thanks for a great episode. Well, you're welcome, Captain Entropy. We actually recorded it just for you. Rob and I talked about it beforehand, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
The amount of things we do just for Captain Entropy would shock you, right?
I mean, right?
The amount
of
things we just do just for Captain.
Well, it's mainly because we like his wife. She's very sweet.
She is very sweet. Doug Adamson, co-host of the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast, who I have, even though he lives in England, I've gotten to have dinner with him and saw a movie. We saw Superman together. It was terrific. He says... He says, hello, Rob, Shag, and the Randomizer, which is nice to give the Randomizer its own little credit. He says, now a confession. I didn't actually know who Sydney Sweeney was until I looked her up after this episode. Oh, you sweet summer child. I can sort of see why she would be a good fit for Power Girl based on her, let's go with resemblance. However, as it's been pointed out, having Power Girl in live action opens too many issues. Unless, of course, she appears via the Peacemaker route, which has... Well, I don't want to spoil it. Made it plausible to have both PG and SG in the same universe. That being said, I thought the face on the Staten art was too cartoonish, and I'm not that impressed with it.
Well, part of the reason we thought of Sydney Sweeney is because the face on that Staten one is so cartoony. That
it looks like her.
Yeah, it
looks
really
like.
Yeah.
Aside from the boob joke, the face looks like Sydney Sweeney's face. But
yep.
God bless you, Doug, that you live in a world. And I have nothing against Sydney Sweeney in particular, really, but like. I just love the fact that like you're that disconnected from the internet scrum. Good for you. Keep it up.
Well, I mean, I didn't know who she was until a couple of years ago too, but I mean like she kind of became the it girl and everywhere for like 20 minutes.
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of hard to miss it. All right. So he goes on to say Animal Man was a highlight both as a solo book and part of the Justice League Europe. I have to admit, I sort of drifted out of Animal Man when it started going weird. Vertigo isn't really where I want to encounter my superheroes, which is why I didn't get Doom Patrol when they moved into that wheelhouse. That being said, that run before things get really nuts was fantastic, and I suspect I probably bailed too soon and should go back and read what I missed. Yeah, I mean, the early issues of the Doom Patrol and Animal Man book, even as you go into the Vertigo stuff, are both really, really good. They get weird as hell further into Vertigo, but the first couple years are really worthwhile. And then he says something that really makes a lot of sense. He goes, why no one has made an Animal Man live action TV show is beyond me. I don't think he's suited to be a tentpole movie, but a TV show set in California as a stuntman and powers, which are easily understandable. This should be on James Gunn's radar. Yeah, like an Animal Man 10 episode sort of series would totally make sense. I mean, you get easy to do powers on TV. You get animal rights sort of stuff. I mean, you get Hollywood sets and fun. It would be a huge hit. Absolutely. Then he talks about everybody's favorite, Quizlet. He says, Quizlet, who I loved in the Legion and I think has been sorely missed in the reboots. That intake of Tellus, Quizlet, and Sensor Girl was my favorite run of the Legion pre-Magic Wars. It's such a shame that all the modern revivals just haven't managed to catch on. Maybe because all the modern runs of Legion are written by old folks in their 50s, and they need to find another 14-year-old like Jim Shooter who is willing to write some sort of soap opera, manga, anime, energy kind of thing, just without the manga art style. Quizlet was one of my favorites, and I often wonder if they're going to make him a fifth dimensional imp or something. If I was bringing him or her nowadays, that's what I would do. And that just goes to prove that every comic is somebody's favorite. And clearly, he loved the Quizlet issues of Legion, which is not something you hear too often.
Since we did the last issue, they announced that they're doing the Jimmy Olsen TV series, and it's like, but it's not a Jimmy Olsen show. Like he's going to be the star of the first season because it's like a DC comics series, but like it's about like solving mysteries or something or that kind of thing. So like, and the first villain is going to be Gorilla Grodd. So if they can do Gorilla Grodd, can Animal Man be that far behind?
Well, right. Well, and they even did the Gorilla Grodd on the Flash TV series too. So I mean, yeah. I mean, Animal Man's it just makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Blue Devil could be a supporting character anyway.
Don't get greedy. No Atari. No. Shag's like trying to throw everybody in there. Noah Tarnow, creator of the Big Quiz thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast, says another great episode. My thoughts. My sister had that Simon game and I hated it. At first you think, hey, I'm pretty good at this. And then after 2 minutes, you can't keep up. Your brain starts melting and you begin to think you're a complete dummy. It was such a tease. Sorry to bring up this trauma for you, Noah.
Apparently, Noah was sitting there with me at dinner tonight because I was trying Simon and it kicked my butt. So I felt exactly as he described.
He says, Rob, I don't understand your hatred of Quizlet beyond your general Legion aversion. I was especially into LSH when he joined. He was a refreshing change of pace from the typical Legionnaire who looked like any typical white person you could find in downtown Boise, Idaho. Yes, I understand why. It was the 60s, but the LSH, God, it's hard to say as an acronym, was supposed to bring together heroes from throughout the galaxy, so its lack of diversity was especially puzzling. I first heard of the Scavenger when he was listed under villains on Aquaman's Superpowers info card. In fact, if memory serves, that card listed four villains: Scavenger, Black Manta, Ocean Master, and Fisherman, the same four who got Huzu listings. Coincidence? Meanwhile, as a kid, I fantasized that every villain listed for all the heroes would eventually get an action figure. The Duke of Deception would have been a massive seller.
Now, to be fair, Noah, I mean, Aquaman really only has four villains, and you just named
pretty much.
So there
we go. Pretty much, yeah. Regarding Quizlet, I have to say, like, my thing against Quizlet is that I'm comparing the Legion to the Justice League, which to me is like, the Justice League to me should be the preeminent heroes of the DCU. And that's why I never liked Vibe and Vixen and Gypsy. Maybe not so much Vixen, but that's why I didn't like Vibe and Gypsy. Because I was just like, that's not what the JLA is. And I always thought of the Legion as the future version of that. But that's not really fair. That's maybe not what the Legion is. I'm making them like a futuristic version of the Justice League, and that's not exactly right. So when I look at somebody like they really land in like a little robot creature, like what the hell? But that's maybe what the book is. So maybe I'm being a little unfair to Quizlet.
No, it should be more like a futuristic Teen Titans, maybe, because they're mm-hmm. supposed to be teenagers, you know, and right. they let in Narc. So, or Gunark, or whatever you call the caveman.
Yeah.
So
Bumblebee and Mal and all this, the Golden Eagle for Pete's sake. So yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Danny Chase. Speaking of the name Oliver, but anyway, then he goes on to say, I Vampire, one detail I will always remember from the first time you covered this entry was Shag, or maybe it was Rob, said that the main drawing looked like Bennett is impatiently waiting for his kids to take out the trash. Speaking from experience, Papa Matthews, honestly, I don't remember which one of us said that. I think it's hilarious, and I'll own it if you want me to. I love it. Then he says another villain whose legacy was picked up by other heroes was Kronos, because that was a topic we came up with last time. Was like, what are the names of some villains that later on a hero adopted the same name? Kronos was one of them. I missed that. He did. There was a dude who had his own series. He says he was more of a tweener than a hero, but still close enough, I'd say. So there, no, good call. Kronos was a good one. They were from Jeff Tischer, who did his usual whatever happened to kind of thing. Talks about a bunch of characters, so I'll just rattle off a few here. Animal Man, Buddy is a member in good standing with the Justice League Unlimited. He has had some rough personal times since the loss of his son, Cliff. That makes me very sad to hear, Jeff. I did not know that Cliff had passed away. That's very sad. He says his daughter, Maxine, is known as Animal Girl and is a good friend of Wally West's daughter, Iris. Yeah, so I know her, like Irie and Maxine hang out a lot, which is really cool. Then he says, Clue Master, Arthur Brown has faked his death several times, always coming back to torment his daughter, Spoiler. He was last seen being taken to jail after accidentally fatally shooting Spoiler, but she was saved by fellow Batgirl Cassandra Cain using some Lazarus serum. That sentence pretty much describes why I'm confused by many new DC comics. But. Then the Global Guardians says the events of Doomsday Clock fragmented the members into various national superhero teams. Since that time, there's been several groups that have emerged with similar missions, like the Euro Corps, which is basically just like Europe, the New Global Guardians, and the Official Global Guardians. They attempted to reorganize into one team during Absolute Power, but their infighting led them all to be drained of their powers and captured by Amanda Waller. Jeez, Global Guardians can never catch a break. They really can't. Now, last episode, Rob, I don't know if you remember, we talked about Power Girl. I told you how she's going by the name Paige now and how she had gotten mental powers and all this stuff. And she was hanging out with Lilith. Well, he says Power Girl, Paige's mental powers and astral punch were a result of the Lazarus planet event, which messed up some heroes' powers. They have both dissipated with time. She just finished up her series where she's reestablished her fortune, started a new company called Stargraze, and has ceded the name of Karen Starr to the villain Ejectra, saying that she no longer has need of it. So that's encouraging. It sounds like maybe Power Girl is going to kind of reassess and get back to what she's all known for rather than the whole mental power thing. And then Scavenger says Peter Mortimer has upgraded his suit in recent years. It can now create electrical shocks, interface with nearly any computer, and teleport. He was last seen taken into custody after being in a three-way fight with Black Manta and the Aquaman family. Oof, okay. Then you missed a comment on Supermobile, so I'll cover it for you.
Oh, how did I do that?
He says that Supermobile was used by Damian Wayne to keep up with Jonathan Kent in the 2020 series Challenge of the Super Sons. I got to tell you, Rob, I know this is probably nowhere on your radar, and you probably don't care. But in the 2020s, they did a series called Super Sons and the Challenge of the Super Sons, featuring Superman's son, Jonathan Kent, and Batman's son, Damian Wayne. And it is one of the best comics DC's done in years. It was so much fun. And I just cannot recommend those books highly enough. If you happen to run across some of it, just read it for fun. I think you'll have a good time.
Can I just ask you one thing about it?
Yep.
I don't really care, but I am like, yeah. So where are they born? Like, what's the timeline of this? Is like, is the Batman and Superman of this current DCU iteration? They've been parents for 15 years now.
No, the kids are very young. They're like eight. Well, okay, I think Damian's only like 11 or 12.
All right. So. 11 or 12. Well, all right. That's close enough. I'm saying, is the Superman and Batman that currently exist in the DCU, they have been parents for 10 years? Is that what they're saying?
Yes and no. It gets really... All right, okay. You open this can of worms. Well, first of all, Batman didn't know we had a son. So for a long time. Okay. Talia kept it from him.
Okay, so it's kind of a spinoff of Son of the Demon, sort of.
It's exactly. It's, yeah. Okay. And so he doesn't find out about the baby till much later. So by the time Damian's already like a trained assassin kind of thing. So in theory, Damian's only been in his life maybe a couple years at this point now. Whereas Jonathan Kent, this is where it gets super confusing. Mm-hmm. So the new 52 comes along, reboots the whole universe, right? There's a brand new Superman. He's kind of different. And that dude died. Like Superman straight up died like after a few years in the new 52 because it just wasn't working. So they told this retroactive story that said our Superman from the post-crisis universe, the John Byrne Superman, somehow survived Flashpoint, ended up in the new 52, and him and Lois just lived on a farm. They just lived out on a farm, and he secretly would sneak out and help people, but not as Superman. He would just secretly go out and help people, and they had a son. And so, yes, he raised a son from birth to age like, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, whatever, Jonathan Kent. So him and Lois raised this son. Once the Superman of New 52 dies, Clark, this version of Clark becomes the new Superman. And then they did some weird merging crap later. I don't know, whatever. But so, yeah, Superman and Lois raised their son. That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. Now I know.
Yep. Whew. Okay. There you go, folks. And I know I missed a lot, so I don't need like a book of like what I missed, guys. It's okay. Back to Jeff Tischer and the Supermobile, which is what really matters. He says, additionally, the Supermobile has been used in the new Superman Unlimited series so that Clark can journey to the country of El Caldero, whose whole economy and infrastructure are made of kryptonite. The country doesn't wish Superman any harm, but at the same time refuses to give up the kryptonite because it has turned them into a world superpower and completely changed everything for the better of their society. I love that idea that this whole, you know, country has like made a gazillion dollars off kryptonite. They're like, no, sir, man, no, like, no bad. We don't hate you, but we need the money. You know, I just love this idea. Then Jeff said he heard a rumor at the Baltimore Comic Con, which, by the way, makes me sad, Jeff, that we were both at Baltimore Comic Con and didn't get to meet. He says, I heard a rumor at Baltimore Comic Con last week that there is a new iteration of Who's Who in the works. It would make sense since they just wrapped up the new history of the DC Universe. Jeff, I hope that's true, but this is, I think, the third time I've heard that rumor since we've started the Who's Who podcast. So last time, I think Dan DiDio said it. So, I mean, it's probably more likely than any of the other times, but I'm not going to hold my breath till I see issue one on the stands.
Amazing. Amazing.
Well, I mean, they know it makes money. Now that they've sold the omnibuses, they know there's money to be made there. So then we're from Diablo Frank from the World Spine Podcasting Network and the DC Secret Files podcast and more. He says, I'm sure Rob calling Captain Boomerang short at 5'9" is relative to the baseline of 6 foot for characters in the DCU. But we got a lot of short kings in the audience that maybe bristle at that. 5'9" is literally the average height of the adult men in the United States and Australia. So there you go, Rob. Mocking people that are under. I by the way, for the record, I'm 5'8", so you better step off there, buddy. You know, you'd be nice to not quite tall people. How's that?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's cute, little guy.
Oh. I'm gonna punch you in your kneecap. And he says, "I've always liked Cluemaster's look too, but I guess in another light, he looks like a." He looks like a pumpkin egregiously laced with Viagra. Oh my God. The blue pills. Oh my God. And then he says, I love how Eduardo Barreto presents the Global Guardians so much here. They look like what they're supposed to be, the Justice League of the World. I like that he said that because I totally agree, Frank. That is what that entry looks like, the Justice League of the World. So, Frank goes on to say, so of course, in a universe where anyone who threatens Superman's supremacy invariably gets nerfed, the Global Guardians, admittedly non-threat to the League, was met by mockery, dissolution, and outright villainizing. There was an attempt at a redemption arc serialized in Justice League Quarterly, but we more or less rightly do not discuss Justice League Quarterly in these circles. Yes, we do not discuss Justice League Quarterly for the most part. That's exactly correct. And then we had joked about a podcast called Who the Hell. He says, I think Shag will agree there's already a podcast called Who the Hell, but it's called DC Secret Files instead. I will suggest another contender, though. Some of the Fire and Water Network All-Stars should get together and produce a single episode of Who's Who at Atlas Comics to cover all their suspiciously familiar characters like the Scorpion and Demon Hunter. That would be fun. I would dig that. Then we're from Joe X. Now, this is a long-distance dedication to Joe X. Joe, first off, we need you to check your email. Second off, we need you to listen to the November episode of DC Special Cast, which had a special message about the Avengers draft episode that we did. So hopefully we'll hear from you soon, Jeff. Joe, not Jeff, sorry, Joe X. Joe goes on to say, you could get a decent series set in Hollywood. Joe is writing things just for me here. He says, you could get a decent series set in Hollywood with Animal Man, Blue Devil, Elastigirl, Beast Boy, Greg Saunders, Gregory Reed, Daphne Dean, and any other actor characters. The villain would be Clayface, both Basil and Hagen, and Film Freak. Oh my gosh, Joe, you're writing a comic just for me, man. That would be amazing. Then we talked a lot about Dr. Light last time, right? And he says, Marv Wolfman had a massive writer block case after Crisis, cutting off a lot of his plans, presumably including Dr. Light. And for his Plasmas art, oh, I had talked about the Plasmas art, and I said I could have sworn there was another writer turned a writer who drew an entry, and that would be Mark Waid drawing Parody. So thank you, Joe, for clearing that up.
Well, there's another one. Mark Evanier draws the Yellow Perry listing.
Oh, Super good point.
He did that one too, so... Sean Ross from this very network, by the way, Shag, don't try and change the title. You put, you're editing it as I'm trying to read it. You originally wrote Sean Ross of the Peach Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, which I believe is a brand of Arizona tea that you can get out there.
that's a lot cleaner than I was going for. I was thinking about Wonder Woman and a peach, but anyway.
No. He says, great episode, guys. I wonder, is Animal Man the most successful example of a completely new take on a character that still maintains all that came before? Maybe the Winter Soldier. You know, I read this when I highlighted it, and I've been trying to think of another example, and I can't really think of one, right? Where a reboot, but it's not a reboot, and that the Animal Man in the Vertigo series is the Animal Man from Strange Adventures.
Yeah.
But it is a reboot in terms of pretty much every other thing. So,
I mean,
Swamp Thing?
It was Swamp Thing's a good one. Yeah. That was very, very different. I mean, you could almost argue someone like Robin. I mean, Robin was one thing in the Golden Age, but then he's completely different by the time he gets to Nightwing. You know, I mean, but that's not really a massive reinvention. That's just time. You know, 80 years doing that. Huh. That's a good, like, basically when Rob highlights stuff, I don't read what he writes because I want to be surprised when we get on the air. So I hadn't had time to think about this question. I'm going to have to think about it. And folks, actually, you write in too. If you think of another character like Animal Man who got a complete reinvigoration and really a kind of a transformation, but still maintains everything that came before, that would be interesting. I think you're on a good one with Swamp Thing there, Rob.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like it being successful, that's the thing. Because I can think of a lot of reboots that just didn't go anywhere. You know, but Animal Man ran what, like 70 issues or something? 60?
71 or something in that ballpark.
I mean, that's a great run. You know? So Gothos Manchet says, I hate to be that guy. Then don't be that, Gothos. But Batman 336 wasn't written by Jerry Conway. It was plotted by Barbara Zachas and scripted by Roy Thomas. We have to credit Roy where it is due, because even if we don't, I'm sure he'll claim it anyway. I wholeheartedly agree that it is a great issue. Yeah, and I responded to Gothos. He's right. I was off by one issue. Jerry Conway took over the full writing with the next issue. So I just got it. I was just off by one. But it's, you know, worth bringing up. It's worth getting right. But so you're right about that, Gothos.
Then he says, Shaq, I found your comments about your wife yelling at you saying, who is Power Girl? To be hilarious. It reminded me of when I was a young whippersnapper and I had to depend on my mom to buy comics. Anytime I bought the X-Men because of Storm, or Teen Titans because of Starfire, or the Legion because of Saturn Girl, Shadowlast, and Dawnstar, I had to make sure they were in the middle of the pile between Batman, Spider-Man, Hulk, and Superman to put them on top. Totally off subject, but my real comic book crush was Batgirl, and she was more covered up than just about anyone. Oh, Gothos Manchin. I totally see a kinship in our youth.
Tim Price, host of Outcasters, the Batman and Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl and Huntress podcast, says, what a great set of characters. The randomizer sometimes is generous, but woe unto you when it is not. Woe indeed. Anyway, my random thoughts. He says, I dare say the Animal Man entry might have single-handedly given Buddy the miniseries that extended into his ongoing title. Just think, he was one of the first entries in Who's Who, period. That alone might have raised his profile. In another timeline, this would have led to an Angleman ongoing.
Oh, my gosh. He goes on to say, since Richard Dragon was mentioned in this episode, there's actually a Captain Boomerang connection with Richard Dragon. I read the Richard Dragon Kung Fu Fighter Omnibus and DC Ultimate back in June for research and funsies, and I saw in the final issue of the series a prisoner named Harkness speaking some bad Australian lingo. So it had to be Digger, but with no mention of his Captain Boomerang identity. So that's wild for being such a subtle nod to another DC character in that series, but also that two of the central characters from Suicide Squad appeared in the same comic book about 10 years before that series. Wow. Interesting. Okay.
And then he wraps up with, I adore the Supermobile entry. I had that same issue featuring Amazo back in the day. Gosh, I say that a lot. The story was bonkers, lives rent-free in my head, and the Supermobile was simply too awesomely retro. Great Zoom 2 edition.
And what was the name of that robot again?
Amazo.
That's not what you're saying. You're saying Amazo. It's weird.
All right, Amazo.
It's getting late. So then we're here from George Van Note. It says, I went through a short but memorably passionate Superman phase when I was about 4 years old. I had a pair of red sneakers, and I called my mom Lois. The quirky Supermobile was always my favorite matchbox, more than the Batmobile, and I never read the comic book appearances, but I always assumed his primary purpose was to protect him from Kryptonite, and the hands were to dispose of it. There we go, George. We're on the same page. Then he says, keep boop-booing. We will, George. Don't you worry.
Thanks, George. Boop. Brett Young, of course, also from this network, hosts the Fantastic Poor podcast, says, really nice art for Dr. Light. Light seemed like she was going to be a big deal coming out of Crisis, but then she got Supergirl killed and the Justice League dumped her in an issue. Too bad. She had potential. Finally, I'm always amazed by Zoom Zoo's entries and the tireless work that went into them. Good on Isamu for continuing his dad's legacy.
Absolutely.
Co-sign that.
Yep.
Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailey Jude podcast network says, during the Supermobile entry, I really did highlight him.
You really did. Yeah.
During the Supermobile entry, Rob suggested we could see this in the next Superman movie. And Shag was all like, that would never happen. And I stopped and said, wait a second. That man that put, checks notes, Crypto the Superdog, the Fortress Robots, Guy Gardner in a bowl cut, and the effing hypno glasses in the first film would draw the line here. I get that we're in uncharted territory when it comes to see what we'll see in a DC film, and the Snyder era was a damp squib when it came to anything resembling fun, but a Supermobile is not out of the realm of possibility in this new era. I also had a fun flashback to doing Treasury Cast with Rob a few months ago, and his reaction to me explaining the last few years of Superman continuity as Shag explained the terrible things they've been doing with Power Girl. If people love it, fine. I'm not going to be the old man yelling that I didn't fight in no World War II to have these kids run on my lawn. But that whole thing is a bad call, Ripley. A bad call.
Okay. All right. Oh, by the way, I'm excited to announce Treasure Cast is coming back because Rob is going to do a whole series covering the Youngblood Treasury that's coming out. Isn't that right, Rob?
No, that's completely wrong.
And that will probably be edited out of the final show. You probably didn't hear that joke. Anyway, then we heard from Sybil Pending from the PowerCo blog. Says, so it seems like as good a time as any to reveal my secret origins. Back in 2019, I got my first smartphone. So I was able to get into podcasts in a big way, rapidly working my way through the JLI and, more importantly, Who's Who. With so many podcasts, I began to wonder how easy it would be to make my own podcast. Very difficult, it seems. To answer your question, Sybil Pending, yes, it is a royal pain in the butt to make a podcast. Anyway, it goes on to say, but who would I do a podcast about? Enter the Who's Who podcast episode about this issue, where Rob was going on and on about PG's weight, a common discussion amongst a lot of characters. The conversation basically goes on and on about just how much her assets weigh. At that point, I thought Power Girl must be more than just a series of massive boobs. So after checking around to see what else there was out there, I decided to start a blog about PG, and the rest is history. So basically, it's all Rob's fault. Now, I will say, in Rob's defense, I think it was actually me that insisted on talking about the weight of her breasts, because I actually had a conversation with my wife, and I had done a bunch of, research about how much a breast weighs. So I think that's actually my fault, but either way, I'll let you take the blame. That's fine with me.
That does sound like you, though.
Sadly, really does. All right, folks. Well, this is the part of the show where we thank everyone who shared the Who's Who Review podcast on their social media timeline. This will be Facebook, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I know this sounds like a long list of names, like I'm reading a phone book with weird people, but we want to recognize every single person to help promote the show. Because, like, it's important to us. Like, this is the only time that Ed Moore is going to get mentioned on the show. But, you know, he's part of our family. So it is important to us to recognize everyone in the Who's Who community. So, apologize for anyone that we may have missed. So if I did, please let us know. But thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Friaitis, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer, Black Vulcan 69, Brett Young and his Imaginate Design, Brian Schufo, Chris A. Field, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Mort, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave and his Brick Crisis Network and Monitor Tapes podcast, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Ed Moore, John Stibe, Kara Lovett, Keechee Baker, Connell,
Mark Baker Wright, Max Romero, Mike Jameson, The Lightsaber That Kills Fascists and Sleazebag Cinema, Miracle Man, Movie Matt Sirois, Paul Kinn, Prayer of Justice, The Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast, Queen Raina, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Richard Field, Rick Austin, S. Matthew Stolt, Scott X, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Steve Givens of the JLA Stories and Friends Podcast, Sybil Pending, Tim Price of the Outcasters, and a Batman and the Outsiders podcast.
Well, thank you all so much for your feedback on this episode. Please leave your feedback out there for Who's Who Review number 11. We want to hear your thoughts on Onyx. I need to hear deep. I want fan fiction. I expect fan fiction on Onyx and so much more, folks. So go out to firewaterpodcast.com. Leave your thoughts there. Again, please share these posts on Facebook. You can share them on Blue Sky and on Instagram. I don't know if you know, Instagram has a little reshare button now. You can do the heart and you can do a reshare. So share those posts out there from the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Instagram. So that's it, Rob. A lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. It's always a good time. I'm glad we got to do one more of these than we normally would, right? Because there was one month that had an extra Sunday or something like that.
No, it's just 4 a year. This year it's just four a year.
Okay,
yep.
All right.
Yep, 4 a year, and I already looked. It's 4 next year as well. So you'll get one 4 times a year. So there we go. In fact, it'll be March 2026 when we do our next episode.
Wow, that doesn't feel like a real date, right? March 2026.
I had to write 2027 on something recently for work,
wow.
And I'm just like. That sounds like a fictional movie.
Yeah,
that
sounds like the setting of a tryout run of some book and showcase that didn't last, right?
Like it's exactly,
something 2027.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, like, you know, that Lee Majors movie where he's driving a car across America when there's no gas. Like I feel like that's 2027 or something.
Amazing, amazing stuff.
All right, well, that's gonna do it, folks. Thank you again for listening, and until next time,
who's
next?
Next, that one was really bad.
That was really bad.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia, and Woody.
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
The Green Arrow, crime fighter from the forest,